Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here on the big program. They're back. They're back. Yeah, the General Assembly back in. Okay, it's nice to have a couple of days off, a couple of weeks. Nice to go back into the district, you know, hide out in your office a little bit. Dream up new ALEC pieces of legislation to come, you know, like a kid on the day with your homework. See, I did something. Yeah, so much fun. So much fun to talk about and to watch. I'm sure Senate Bill 1085, something we're going to talk about tonight, high on the list of priorities. The Let's Hand Our Education Money Over to Profiteers and Campaign Donors Act of 2013, under the guise of education reform. That's high on the priority list. Also, Seth Groves, Handcuff Local Communities Act, Steal Power and Authority Away from Local Governments Act, House Bill 1807. We'll talk about that also. My other favorite, Let's Lock Up Workers Who Dare Talk to Anyone Act. The House Bill 1154, basically taking us back to the good old days of injunctions. Can't wait for that. Three people standing on the corner. Nope, can't have that. Got to break that stuff up. That's where we're heading, man. That's where we're heading. Also going to talk about Bill Clinton entering into the healthcare fray. And are we going to build anything next year? Are we going to see any transportation money? Anything coming up? Maybe yes, maybe no, maybe no, never. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. To me, the big story in my view, and something that grabbed my attention, and I go, well, it is about freaking time. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon went to the Chamber of Commerce to give a big policy speech. And he said, look, please, we need to have a moratorium on stealing jobs in Kansas City. Because understand, Kansas City is Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas. Obviously, Jay Nixon is in Kansas City, Missouri, and Republican Senator Sam Brownback Mountain, he is the senator in Kansas. They've been stealing jobs back basically from Kansas City, Missouri to Kansas City, Kansas, in huge numbers, huge tax subsidies. And basically back and forth, you're seeing this. And now you're going, you know, you've got a governor going, hey, we got to have a moratorium on this. It's killing us. And what he pointed out is since 2009, this border war in Kansas City has shifted more than 6,000 jobs back and forth from state to state, whichever way, you know, whoever's got the check. And according to report, it has drained more than $210 million in income tax revenue from the states. Both states. I mean, both states are losers in this. And this is what just kind of leaves me scratching my head. Because according to the report, you had $210 million in tax revenues lost. All of this handout, all of these sweeteners, all of these special deals, tax abatements, land grants, all of this stuff with no net gain to the local economy. Nothing. And Nixon said in his speech, he goes, look, it's bad for taxpayers. It's bad for our state budgets. It's bad for our economy. And then the kicker comes. Hampering our ability to compete as a region. So saying, look, Kansas, we can stop beating each other up. Let's go after Oklahoma, or let's go after somebody else. Let's stop beating each other up. Let's come together. And I kind of thought that that's what the country was supposed to do. As an entire nation, we were one nation. And I love the thumpers who say it's one nation under God, except in trade where we beat the living you know what out of each other. But you know what it is? It makes me go, somebody's going, we should probably stop this. It's not good. We should probably stop all of these sweeteners and all of these incentives. And the article goes through a ton of jobs that, you know, just moved across the border, kind of like Pennsylvania did with New Jersey here not too long ago, and when the governor was out there touting those 50-some jobs that he brought from New Jersey from right across the river into the east and from right across the river. No new jobs. not even changing in bodies, just changes in taxes. And you go, well, who benefited? I would argue nobody did, except the companies. They do very well, thank you very much. And why wouldn't they? They're the ones who are pushing for this. They're the ones who love this system. They love the system that sets up, it goes, hey, just keep giving us money. We'll go wherever the money's at. Good capitalists. And, you know, our guy, Tom Corbett, he's one of them, too. You're not going to see him come out and say, no, we don't want to give sweeteners away. Because remember, he's the more jobs, less taxes governor, who today endorsed by former governor and former shale lobbyist Tom Ridge. You kind of go, there's a common denominator there. Shale money and lots and lots and lots of it. Now, what's interesting to me is you got Ridge coming out this soon. He's not being primaried. There's no real reason for you to come out and say, I endorse him, other than his approval and favorability ratings. Somewhere in the neighborhood between cockroaches and herpes. Somewhere right around that area. An abysmal, abysmal approval rating. But, you know, they had to have their little conference and their little smiling, you know, here we are. Because his polling numbers are just horrible. And when you look at a sitting duck governor like Corbett, you know, then the media is going, well, who are the Democrats who are going to beat him? So they did a poll, this Harper polling, did a quite an interesting poll that says Alison Schwartz is the leader right now, with 22% of the folks saying, I want Alison Schwartz. Kathleen McGinty, about 15%, Rob McCord, about 12%, Hanger, about 7%, Pawlowski, 6%, Wolf, about 5%. And then there's this other person, this other entity, not sure. And not sure had the majority of the votes with 34%, so beat them all. You go down the list, and not sure seemed to be kicking everybody's behind. Yeah, when you talk about image, when you talk about favorability, you talk about all this. Not sure, pretty high up on the list. And at this point, I wouldn't be surprised that not sure. But here's the thing. I think everybody has coalesced around the idea that Corbett's not the guy. So he can go out there and say, I'm the more jobs governor. And he throws out his facts. The Marcellus Shale Fast Facts Report. And you gotta love this. Finally, somebody looked at these job numbers, something we've been talking about for a while. Because originally, when they were saying, well, we created all these Marcellus Shale jobs, originally their accounting went like this. We have one job. One guy gets it. He quits. Another guy takes 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 it. He gets fired. Another guy takes it. He's working on it. That's six jobs. Now, it's one actual job, but six people had it at one point or another. So that's six jobs. And that's what they were doing for a while until people wised up to it and realized, hey, you know, the 100,000 jobs that you're touting was really like seven. So now they've run around and they've come up with a new scheme. And the new scheme is core oil and gas extraction and pipeline jobs and all of the other stuff. 200,000 jobs. All of the jobs that the natural gas industry supports. 200,000 jobs. Big number. 200,000. And then you look at the data. You look at the form that they put out. The industry data from the quarterly census of employment and wages. And you go, hold on. When did Corbett take office? Oh, 2011. Right. He was elected in 2010. These numbers show 2009. And in 2009, there were 190,462 jobs in the big picture that they throw out there. So there's 190,000 jobs before he took office. Today, according to the numbers that they use, today there are 203,000. So really, just right from the start, you go, well, wait a second. I passed third grade math. 203 take away 190 leaves me 13,000. So you created 13,000 jobs during your time as governor. not 200,000. And look, you're the worst job creating governor in the country right now. Congratulations on that. Put that on your bumper sticker and stick it. But then you look at how they came across this number, which is just mind-blowing how you come up with the 203,000. Your truck drivers, people who make machinery, iron and steel mill manufacturing, and all, you know, all this stuff. Water and sewage treatment plants. So, you know, a water and treatment plant in Carlisle where there's no Marcellus shale there yet. Nobody's drilling. I haven't seen any drills yet. So if there's anybody employed there, those are Marcellus shale jobs. And you go right down the list of all the, you know, water treatment plants, sewage treatment plants, highway and street and bridge construction. So the guys who are working and the guys and gals who are working, on what little road construction we're doing, that's in there as well. And you go, wait a second. How is that road project in Philadelphia connected to the, it's not, just shut up and listen. We created 23,000 jobs and you know it. No, not so much. And, you know, it looks nice on paper, and it has a nice ring to it. We invested in millions and millions of dollars. In fact, $1.7 billion to one Royal Dutch Shell to build a cracker plant. So you're talking about a huge investment. And they want us to believe that because Corbett didn't tax the drillers, that Corbett didn't do at least what West Virginia has done or what Texas has done. In taxing the drillers, that somehow he's responsible for the growth of the gas industry. When the reality is the drilling industry was happening before he took office, and as the numbers bore out, about 13,000 more, even of the numbers that he's using and touting, of things that have almost nothing to do with the Marcellus Shale. But you know, don't think about that. Don't look behind the curtain. Now understand, let's just argue, because, you know, he's saying that X amount of jobs, that, you know, there are 28,000 direct, Marcellus Shale jobs. And the multiplier on that takes you up to 203,000. I'm of the mindset that if we pass a transportation bill, and this is just a thought, if we pass that transportation bill, and Stephen LaTourette, the Republican from Ohio, when he served in Congress, said, for every $1 billion of investment, you create 41,000 jobs. Now, if we create 41,000 jobs with $1 billion in investment, we're talking about $2.5 billion. So you're talking about 100,000 jobs being created. If I use the Corbett multiplier, that's going to take us well over a million jobs. Now, there are only about 500,000 people unemployed in Pennsylvania. That puts us at negative unemployment. That means that we've got negative unemployment, which then I would say, yes, yes, sir, you are the more jobs governor. But that's not what he's done. Not even close. So the question is, who's going to hold him accountable? And he's going to get beat up over this a lot over the next couple of days. But remember, you heard it here first. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. We're going to talk a little bit about education. Senate Bill 1085 up before the legislature. What's that mean? We'll find out when we come back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We cannot expect our economy to work when so many families are buying groceries with food stamps because we're not paid enough for our work. Walmart is paying hundreds and thousands of workers less than $25,000 a year. And to those who speak out about this, Walmart is a bully who tries to silence us.
Walmart worker Barbara Gertz. More than 50 workers were recently arrested in Los Angeles as Walmart workers went on strike for better wages, more hours, and the right to form a union without employer retaliation. The first Black Friday anniversary of the Walmart Walmart workers' strike actions is approaching, and workers like Los Angeles Walmart striker Anthony Goitia are more determined than ever to stand up and demand that Walmart pay living wages.
Even though more than 100 our Walmart members have been disciplined or outright fired by Walmart for speaking up, we're still standing up and we're still speaking out. My co-worker Carlson Smith worked for Walmart for 17 years and was fired for no other reason than being courageous enough to tell Walmart that workers have the right to speak out for things like better wages and better jobs. I'm putting my ability to feed my children on the line and taking this courageous act because I can't and won't wait any longer for Walmart and its illegal retaliation against those of us who have been calling for better wages and full-time work.
The U.S. Postal Service has reached a deal with Amazon.com to deliver the company's packages on Sundays. Jesse Russell reports.
Starting immediately, Sunday delivery of Amazon packages will start in Los Angeles and New York City greater metropolitan regions. In 2014, that will expand to other cities. The Postal Service has been losing money mostly due to a congressional mandate requiring 75 years of retiree benefits be invested by 2016. Without that mandate, it has been projected that the service would have turned a profit this year. Saturday package delivery is more profitable for the service than first-class mail delivery. Sunday delivery will also give the Postal Service an advantage over businesses like UPS and FedEx, who currently don't service customers on Sundays. The Postal Service plans to negotiate Sunday delivery with other businesses in the online commerce sector.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender. Doing whatever it takes to meet your business lending needs for new construction, remodeling, or building training facilities. Online at bankoflabor.com.
I'm Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News. Since 2002, Workers Independent News has put worker voices and issues on hundreds of radio stations. But unless we raise enough money very quickly, that ends November 15th. So please go to laborradio.org and click donate now to save when. Madison, Wisconsin-based Workers Independent News was in the thick of the 2011 Wisconsin worker uprising that inspired the world. Inspire us now by saving Workers Independent News. Laborradio.org and click donate.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education like better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
Yeah, I listened to that quote, and look, we play that clip often because I think it's so important to understand that that woman is a state representative. She is someone who has a vote in what happens to our children's education, and I would argue she's in with a lot of what's going on and what's gone wrong with our education system. This idea that we're going to bring profiteers, we're going to bring businesses into school, like how? Are we going to sell space on the kids' report cards like they're doing in Golden, Colorado because they need money because they've been starved? Are we going to put ads on the sides of buses? Are we going to put television screens in the bus seats so commercials can run the entire ride? What more do we do to exploit our kids' education? It's just, it's mind-blowing. And you look at the money that we're wasting on these charter schools. And we talked about it the other day, the Solomon Charter School down in Philadelphia. I guess they were a cyber charter school. Had some office space, though. Evidently 7th through 11th graders were supposed to go into this building, right in the same floor, same vicinity as the sex offenders clinic. Yeah, it's a good, if I were choosing a site for my charter school, I think right next to a bunch of pedophiles would probably be the right spot. Anyway, they closed their doors October 30th, and guess what? The cash-strapped Philadelphia School District gets to pick up the $305,000 bill left behind by them. So congratulations. And now what you've got is you've got Senate Bill 1085, which is going to have this direct pay provision in it that local school districts, the local school board, they're not going to be able to see any of it. It's going to go right from the state right to the Solomon Charter Schools of the world. And then we have no accountability, no transparency, none of that. I'm telling you, it's a ripoff. So which is why we've asked Brett Schaefer, Communications Director for the Education Law Center in Philadelphia, to come talk to us. Brett, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Happy to be on the show and talk a little bit.
You know,
can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you. I look at this Solomon Charter School, $305,000 the Philadelphia School District's going to get saddled with, and not to mention all of the money that was invested in this charter school to try and get kids' education, not to mention the kids' educations that are lost. It just seems to me to be a fool's errand and a ripoff, and this Senate Bill 1085 is going to make that even bigger.
Yeah, I mean, just to go back for a second to what you were talking about with Solomon. So the way the state charter law works is that cyber charters are approved and then paid from the state. So that's a separate piece. Now your brick and mortar charters are authorized and controlled at the local school district level, as they should be. So they are accountable to those local communities.
Correct.
One of the things that Senate Bill 1085 would do is it would take away some of that local control, as you mentioned, by moving the payment system to the state. The other piece that it would remove, a way to remove local control, is that it would allow a university, any university, could authorize a charter school, a university that has no financial stake and no oversight stake in these schools would just simply approve it, and you would have then charters just popping up left and right, again, with no accountability to those local communities where they operate and where the districts would still have to pay for those kids.
Yeah, and the taxpayers are still paying for it. And it doesn't even have – does it have to be a local university, or could it be one of these online universities that we see these scam – what I think are ripoffs, but, you know, the – some people.
Phoenix, right? Phoenix University.
I wasn't going to bring them up. I wasn't going to bring them up. But since you did, that's what I'm talking about. Could they begin to authorize charter schools to set up a model for K-12 as they have done for higher ed?
The language in the bill doesn't specify. So at this point, it's open. I mean, it doesn't say that they couldn't.
Because I've been saying for years what the game plan is to do to K-12 what they've already started doing to universities and to higher ed, which is a huge profitization, big CEO salaries, and really not much for the students. Kind of a ripoff for the students, but a good profit motive.
Well, you know, I think where that really comes into question at the current time is if you look again at the cyber charters and you look again at K-12, which is this massive national corporation that provides the curriculum and operates a lot of these schools. Pennsylvania right now has 16 cyber charters. And in the western part of the state, we've seen one of the more popular ones, which is
Agora.
And the one that that Nick Trombetta was running.
Right.
So he's now under investigation. So it is a situation where that area, particularly the cyber, it's wide open. There's been almost zero accountability, zero oversight, and we see what happens.
I mean, it's almost the Wild West. And since you brought up Agora Cyber Charter School, evidently, you know, I saw this report that said that they ran 19,000 local TV commercials in Wayne, Pennsylvania, in that area. And you and I and the taxpayers of the Commonwealth, we paid for that.
That is correct. That is correct. Their dollars, they spend a lot of money on advertising.
And they paid their CEO in 2011 $5 million. And you look, I think $150,000 for a superintendent's a lot. You're going to pay a CEO of my kid's school $5 million? Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, some of the stuff is hard to believe.
It's outrageous. It's enraging. And, you know, I think people should be running in the streets screaming, saying, how could you possibly think of expanding this and doing something this insane? Why not take that money from the 19,000 TV commercials and put it back into the schools that need the money that you've been starving for years?
Yeah, and I think, you know, what happened in Harrisburg in the spring is that there were some initial movements, some legislation to address some of the cyber funding issues. You know, a beginning piece to try to address that and eliminate some of those disparities and really look at how we're funding these schools and come up with a better system. And then that just got swallowed up. That got swallowed up by the House charter bill now, 618, and then the Senate bill doesn't really get into that at all. So there is a little bit of appetite to address this in the Capitol to see if we can come up with a better system for funding cybers and the brick-and-mortar charters.
Right. Well, I mean, because you're looking around, you're seeing, you know, the Trumpettas of the world, you know, the June Brown, you're seeing all these people on trial, under investigation, all of this money, the millions and millions of dollars that should be in my kid's classroom and every other parent's kid's classroom in this Commonwealth, you're seeing been misappropriated at best. You want to talk about waste, fraud, and abuse? Here we go. So I look at this and I go, you know, okay, fine, we've wasted all this money, but more importantly, we've wasted those kids' years. I look at Philadelphia, the Frontier Virtual Cyber Charter School. What about those 50 kids or 60 kids who were supposed to be getting an education that, oh, well, you know, man, they missed 2 years. We'll make it up down the road. And what's remediation cost? What's prison cost? We got to really be thinking about this, not in just the way how we fix this animal, but how we fix it right.
Yeah, and, you know, and the data for performance, particularly, again, with the cybers, is terrible. You know, there was a study that looked at them in 2011. None of them were meeting adequate yearly progress benchmarks. Only one of them came close to a graduation rate, the state's average graduation rate of 83%, and yet they're all still operating. You know, the one they, Solomon is the one that they've closed in the last couple of years, and you pointed out one of the reasons why.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this and I understand that charter schools were from their conception. The idea was that we would have little laboratories to experiment and try different things. But sadly, that experiment has gone horribly awry. And what we've got now is a bunch of profiteers coming in saying, hey, how much money can we make? How much taxpayer dollars can we suck out of the local community? And now how much control can we take away from the local community? It just boggles my mind that, you know, the people who tell us that they believe in local control and not, they don't want big government would be pushing this theft of local control. It just doesn't seem to make an awful lot of sense to me, Brett.
Yeah, well, it doesn't, and I think the other piece that we're hearing is this idea of, you hear a talk about accountability. Well, you know, they want to address the accountability, but there's nothing in the Senate bill that really does much to address any of this stuff. Most of the language that's in there about, you know, the accounting, the reporting, the ethics pieces, that's already in the law. They just need to enforce some of that. And, you know, you want to talk about some of the nepotism provisions. One of the things they don't deal with is the idea of elected officials sitting on charter school boards.
Yeah, Hardy Williams.
Yeah, so you would want to, you know, if you're going to talk about accountability, that might be one place to start.
So does Hardy recuse himself from voting on this? I mean, because he, and there are a bunch of them. Look, he's not the only one. There's a bunch on both sides of the aisle. They've got their fingers in these charter schools and this stuff. You know, and how do we hold them accountable?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the question. And I think what we've tried to encourage is to say, look, if you want to improve the accountability, deal with that piece. You know, focus on that and do something that's going to change this law for the better. Don't keep adding in all of these other pieces that you end up with a bill that's so big trying to hit all these different constituencies that it doesn't do anything to improve the situation.
Yeah. One of my other problems with it, Brett, and I'm not a big fan of monopoly. I'm not a big fan of too big to fail. One of my other big problems with this is there appears to be, and you're the guy, the communications director there at the Education Law Center. So I'm hoping that you've got an answer for this for me, because I'm looking at this, and the way I'm reading some of the language is that they would remove any caps on who can own them, how many you can own, and it seems like there's the ability for charter schools to basically monopolize. So you're not just own one or two, but you could eventually have one company own all of them, and our entire school district, all of our school districts, eventually at some point, theoretically down the road, could be one K-12, could be one of these big companies.
I think the concern, and that's, you know, it would definitely create a path towards that. If you remove the ability for an authorizer to cap the enrollment, if you essentially allow a charter to amend its own charter, just from a contract standpoint, that's a strange bit of language. If you think about it, you never really, if you sign a contract with someone, usually both parties have to agree before that contract gets amended.
Usually.
So they would just be able to amend that. And then this idea that a multiple charter school organization would be able, once it had one charter, this is what you're talking about, it could then just keep adding schools. So to your point, you could imagine there would be a scenario where you're right. A charter operator would, in essence, be its own entity, its own district, opening schools, operating much more like a, you know, like a private entity.
With my money.
Exactly. With public dollars.
A couple other things I wanted to get to, because this whole bill, they tell me there are some good things in it, but I keep looking at this and I keep seeing bad things. For instance, if you have a charter school in a district that doesn't offer full-day kindergarten, and the charter school offers full-day kindergarten, the school district has to pay for the charter's full-day kindergarten. For me, I got to be honest, I'm a believer in saying there should be a state law that says all schools should have full-day kindergarten, but it's odd to me that you would put in law that if a charter school offers it and the local public school doesn't, the local school district still has to pay for it for the charter school.
Yeah, well, I would first agree with your point that there should be kindergarten, right? That should happen in
which
Pennsylvania.
Which is not the law in Pennsylvania.
It is not. It is not. Kindergarten is not mandatory. And I would really question whether or not that could happen, honestly, if that language were to remain in the bill as passed. If that were to get passed, I would wonder if that would even be able to stand.
Well, I mean, to be honest, there was talk here in Harrisburg of the Harrisburg School District was actually considering doing away with kindergarten. And we talked to the board member here who said that if the charter school offered kindergarten, the Harrisburg School District had to provide transportation and pay for that kindergarten for the charter schools, even when the public school wouldn't have offered it. Now, fortunately, they found the money, they kept the kindergarten, and none of that happened. But, you know, there was a situation where it could have.
Yeah. Well, and some districts have cut down to half day.
Right.
You know, some districts have been hit hard by the budget cuts have gone to half day kindergarten.
And the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, it's the Smucker Amendment in this, which I understand that, and I said this earlier, I understand the whole charter movement was we're going to innovate. We're going to take public schools. We're going to have public school teachers. We're going to try different things. And they're the laboratories of innovation is the phrase I keep hearing with this. Evidently, and maybe you can correct me if I have this wrong, but according to what's been given to me, the Smucker Amendment is would remove that language that says that charter schools were to serve as these laboratories of innovation, these models of innovation, and they just are.
Right. So in the original law, when it was written in 1997 in Pennsylvania, that language was in there. It's in there now. It exists, and that's what it says. Now, Senator Smucker is the author of 1085. So he, you know, that is true what you said, that language would be removed under 1085. I would add, however, that in prior attempts and other charter bills that have come out of both the Senate and the House, that's been the case from other legislators. So that this is not the first time that in drafting legislation to change the charter law, legislators have tried to amend out that language.
Okay. So it just tells me that this has been something they've wanted for an awful long time.
Yes. And, you know, again, it's this shift at what you talked about, this idea that at one point these schools were intended to be laboratories, to be places that would be able to do things, to try different types of curriculum, different types of pedagogy, different ways to organize a classroom or different approaches to teaching and learning that, if shown successful, would be maybe modeled in other schools in the district, and sort of shared with the district in that way, that there would be more of this collaborative relationship.
And instead, what we've ended up with is people who have developed these programs. They've copywritten them. They're not now proprietary, that the school districts have to actually buy from them, if I'm not mistaken.
In some cases. And I think, what's been lost is you've lost that whole concept, which could have helped the kids. And partly what we see, because a lot of the students that we deal with, a lot of the families that we deal with are typically, students with a disability, students learning English. Sometimes these are students in foster care, homeless. So these are vulnerable kids, and their access to these schools is very limited. They're not charter schools are not typically enrolling high numbers of these types of kids.
Right.
And if you think about what that original model would have been like, it could have been great for these types of kids, right? Like, the different kind of learning environment could have really served some of these student populations very well. And there are some out there. There are a few charters that do a pretty good job of handling different student populations and different approaches to teaching and learning that are successful. But this legislation isn't helping create more of those, right? It's a path of least resistance. We're just going to open the floodgates to see who comes along, and we're just going to let them run a school. It's basically where we're headed.
Yeah, to me, that's a bad idea. So last line of questioning, what do we do? Do we push to stop this? Do we push to change things? I know Representative Roebuck has a piece of legislation that he's pushing that he thinks would fix the charter schools. You know, what do people think? What do people do? What's the action?
I think, we're going to continue to talk to the legislators. I mean, we've talked to Senator Smucker a few times. They do have an interest. They do want to do some improvements to the charter accountability. I think the key is getting that language correct and weeding out the extra language that's just going to undermine any effort at accountability. If you're going to give a 10-year charter, how can you talk about doing anything around accountability? I mean, that's just you're contradicting the very purpose of the bill. So if we can get some of this other language out and focus on the accountability measures, I think there are ways to get this improved, and I think that'll ultimately be a benefit.
Well, we shall see where this goes. I'm not thrilled with the piece of legislation, but we'll see how it changes. Brett Schaefer, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Rick, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Great talking with you. Communications Director for the Education Law Center there in Philadelphia. Quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Sometimes it pays just to go away. You could ask Jim Skinner about that. He was CEO of the hamburger behemoth McDonald's, pulling down a hefty $8.8 million in pay. Last year, though, Skinner retired, and rather than getting a gold watch, he was given a load of gold, so large that even a Brinks armored truck would have been too small to haul it all away. His salary of $753,000 was the least of it. The Big Mac chain also served up $1.7 million to the chief in stock and $3 million in option awards. Then it slathered on another $10.2 million in retirement pay. All that was topped by a super-rich dessert, $11.6 million in incentive pay. What? Why does a guy with millions already on his food tray need any incentive to do his job? Maybe because Skinner found it hard to stomach the biggest part of his job, which was to pay poverty wages to McDonald's 800,000 workers, shove thousands of them onto food stamps and other programs paid for by taxpayers, and lobby aggressively to prevent any increases in minimum wage or any tax hikes on uber-rich elites like him. It's dirty work, but Skinner did it, finally skipping away with a 2012 pay package totaling $27.7 million. Yet, in the phantasmagoric plutocracy of corporate land, too much is not enough. Last year, for the first time ever, the 10 highest-paid CEOs in America hauled in at least $100 million each, even as the great majority of workaday families have lost income. This is Jim Hightower saying, this gaping and ever-widening inequality is the greatest threat to our society's cohesion. Too few people now control an unconscionable and untenable share of America's money and power, using it to grab more of both for themselves.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for? Just surrender and won't hurt at all. Just got time to say your prayer while you're waiting for the hammer to fall.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, I go back to this, that whole local control thing, and Brett Schaefer brought it up there during our conversation. You know that conceivably, you know, you go completely around any local board, any local school board, elected official, any of that, and you could have, and look, I've been saying this for years. The goal eventually, K through 12, will be just like University of Phoenix and these other online for-profit universities that don't have very good graduation rates, don't have very good, you know, look, I've talked to numerous people who have graduated from these programs, and they all say the same thing. I got the degree, and that's, I got the piece of paper, and that's what's important. I don't know that I actually learned anything, but I got the piece of paper. And that's scary, because I've been saying that, you know, that eventually you're going to see that model move down to my kid's kindergarten in a state where it's constitutionally mandated that every kid get an education. And here in Pennsylvania, a public education, which is why it's interesting that, you know, there's this whole push, and I think eventually you're going to see the way they keep stacking the courts. Public will just mean public money. But I find it interesting that the party that tells us that they believe in local control is doing all of this to take away local control. Don't you think it's odd? Don't you think it's a bit hanky that, you know, the people who say they believe in smaller, less intrusive government and that they want local control, not state or not federal control, are taking it away. And I point to this other piece of legislation, and there's a bunch of it that I'm following. House Bill 1807, put forth by Representative Seth Grove, Republican. I think he's from New York, if I'm not mistaken. He is upset, evidently, that in Philadelphia, they attempted to pass a bill that would require employers with more than five employees to provide some sick time, paid time off, be it vacation, be it sick time, according to him. I seem to remember it as sick time. If you're sick, you stay home and you get well. Now, I don't know if his facts are right in his memo, but the fact that he would say, you know what, we're going to take that local control completely away, under the guise of uniformity, I find very interesting. And the memo title, State Preemption of Local Mandated Leave Ordinances, I found to be very interesting as well. because at the end of the day, what he's saying is, I don't believe the local community can make decisions in the best interest of the local community. What he's saying is that the people who put money into my campaign coffers, they're the folks who matter. And so you look at all of this legislation. Now, remember, 2010, they told us it was about jobs, right? It's all about jobs. None of this stuff creates jobs. All it actually does is make the current jobs that we have worse. Sorry, I find it rather interesting. It's just mind-boggling. And it's frustrating and angering. Which is why I don't do, someone like Brett Schaefer's job. I couldn't be that controlled and that reserved. I mean, he stuck to the facts. He stuck to what was. I would just be wanting to rip walls down. I guess it's just my personality. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.thericksmithshow.com.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm on a Mexican radio.
So Rand Paul's back at it again, and you gotta love Rand Paul. At least, he's not gonna let something go to waste. He's gonna go out there and, he's going to pitch his poison, if you will. I don't know if you saw this, but the FDA recently said that they're going to try and phase out trans fats. And I guess last week it came out, said, look, we're gonna try and get rid of this. It's not something that's always been in our food. It's something that has been added over the last several years. And there are a number of studies that say, it leads to obesity. And it has this effect. So you had Rand Paul, who is running around saying, oh, they're coming after your donuts! Did you hear they're coming after trans fats and your donuts? He said the FDA has banned unilaterally. Some unelected bureaucrat has banned trans fat. So I say we line all of them up. I want to see how skinny or how fat the FDA agents are who are making this rule. And not only that, any of them with a BMI over 16 or whatever the number is supposed to mean, I want to see them on a treadmill, and I want some, maybe OSHA, lashing them while they're working on the treadmill. Because if we're going to have a nanny state and everyone's going to eat the right thing, you can't eat a donut. Maybe we ought to just enforce it on government workers first. I love Rand Paul. I love the fact that, you know, head completely uptook us. Now, Dunkin' Donuts and Krispy Kreme, from what I've read, already have stopped using trans fats. They've removed the trans fats out of their donuts. So if you've been eating their donuts, you've already missed it. But it's this kind of, this vitriol, this, oh, the nanny state. Understand, trans fats have not always been. When I was a kid, they weren't there. And the obesity rate was less. What I'm curious about is, where's the outrage that corporate America decided we were going to put this into the products that you and I and everyone else consumes? And then it takes us years to figure out what the heck it is. And then it takes more years to say, well, wait a second, that's not good for us. This isn't a bureaucrat sitting behind a desk, as the Randian would like us to believe. This isn't one guy who got a hair up his you-know-where and said, hey, I'm going to do this. It's not somebody who threw a dart at a dartboard. It's not somebody who flipped a coin or lost a bet. There are study after study after study that put the linkage to this. And what I find interesting is the people like Paul, that the market's always right. The free market's always right because companies don't want to get sued, is their angle. But you look at our current court situation, and really, does anyone believe that if they're harmed by a corporation, that the product liability laws in this country are going to help them? I mean, really, honestly and truthfully, considering that, you know, most class action suits, thanks to our Supreme Court, have been done away with. So good luck finding a lawyer who's going to take a single individual case against a huge multinational corporation. Good luck on that. And I know people like to say, well, I'll just go get a lawyer. And I say, yeah, you can do that if you can afford it. Or if you find one who's willing to take it on a percentage basis. And you know, he's going to take it when he thinks he can win. But I find it interesting that there's all this anger and, well, they're going to make us eat non-trans fatty food. Just nuts. Just absolutely nuts. Anyway, Bernie Sanders yesterday was talking, and look, he's saying he was at, yesterday was Veterans Day. So he said this very simple thing, that, you know, Congress is dysfunctional, but there is a bipartisan agreement to defend our veterans. And he said, look, we need to make sure that there's better emphasis on getting health care for veterans. So, you know, I find it interesting. Rand Paul's talking about donuts. Bernie Sanders, the libertarian's talking about donuts. The socialist is talking about how we take care of our troops, how we take care of the people who supposedly gave us our freedoms. And, you know, he said, look, you know, we've got the best health care in the world. We need to make sure that these veterans get the access to that. And he pointed out, he said that eligibility for benefits is confusing, saying it varies from county to county, and that you need to have some, and I understand, this is the socialist talking, that we need to have some continuity and some oversight, and also some uniformity in getting veterans benefits and making sure people get things. And he said, look, what's going on? It's a disgrace. And he looked at the number of homeless veterans and said, look, while veteran homelessness has gone down by 17% during the Obama administration, you still have veterans sleeping on streets. He said, it's just a disgrace. And he says, you need to have a new piece of legislation passed, and he said, look, it's a bipartisan concern. But Congress is dysfunctional. But you need to get this agreement. And I like Bernie. I mean, to be honest, Bernie's the very first interview I ever did. When I started doing this program back in 2005, he was the very first person that I had the opportunity to talk to. And a very gracious, very smart guy. If only we had more. General William Bester, he is a retired Army Brigadier General. He is a senior advisor at the Jonas Veterans Healthcare Program. And he's the former chief of the Army Nurse Corps. He says, we feel nursing is absolutely key to caring for these veterans. He said, veterans have special needs, special health care needs. He says it's important to start educating the next generation of nurses on what these people are going to need, on what it's like to be taking care of nurses. And what he pointed out, and I found interesting, he said that the survival rates in Afghanistan, over 90%. If you were wounded, over 90% survival, which means you've got more veterans coming back who have really massive medical needs. He said, quote, we're bringing a lot more service members back home than we did in previous conflicts, but a number of these individuals have injuries, whether they be physical, psychological, or emotional injuries that need to be addressed and cared for once they returned home. And he's saying, look, the money's not there. We need to be looking at this stuff. And, you know, this is what I said yesterday. I never want to see the people that we send into war dumped like trash back into the neighborhoods, back into our communities. And it's interesting to me, the people who use them as photo ops, you don't see much coming out of them. You don't see much on the way of helping. A lot of chest thumping and saying, hey, we should have gone. Not so much on taking care of them. And I find it interesting that Bernie, who has been against the war from the beginning, is the guy out there saying, you know, we got to take care of these guys. You did this. We need to take care of them. But I know, we need tax cuts for the very well-to-do. Seems a bit perverted. Just a little bit. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you can go get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, back with hour two.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We cannot expect our economy to work when so many families are buying groceries with food stamps because we're not paid enough for our work. Walmart is paying hundreds and thousands of workers less than $25,000 a year. And to those who speak out about this, Walmart is a bully who tries to silence us.
Walmart worker Barbara Gertz. More than 50 workers were recently arrested in Los Angeles as Walmart workers went on strike for better wages, more hours, and the right to form a union without employer retaliation. The first Black Friday anniversary of the Walmart workers' strike actions is approaching, and workers like Los Angeles Walmart striker Anthony Goitia are more determined than ever to stand up and demand that Walmart pay living wages.
Even though more than 100 our Walmart members have been disciplined or outright fired by Walmart for speaking up, we're still standing up and we're still speaking out. My coworker Carlson Smith worked for Walmart for 17 years and was fired for no other reason than being courageous enough to tell Walmart that workers have the right to count for things like better wages and better jobs. I'm putting my ability to feed my children on the line and taking this courageous act because I can't and won't wait any longer for Walmart and its illegal retaliation against those of us who have been calling for better wages and full-time work.
The U.S. Postal Service has reached a deal with Amazon.com to deliver the company
company's packages on Sundays, Jesse Russell reports.
Starting immediately, Sunday delivery of Amazon packages will start in Los Angeles and New York City greater metropolitan regions. In 2014, that will expand to other cities. The Postal Service has been losing money mostly due to a congressional mandate requiring 75 years of retiree benefits be invested by 2016. Without that mandate, it has been projected that the service would have turned a profit this year. Saturday package delivery is more profitable for the service than first-class mail delivery. Sunday delivery will also give the Postal Service an advantage over businesses like UPS and FedEx, who currently don't service customers on Sundays. The Postal Service plans to negotiate Sunday delivery with other businesses in the online commerce sector.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender. Doing whatever it takes to meet your business lending needs for new construction, remodeling, or building training facilities. Online at bankoflabor.com.
I'm Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News. Since 2002, Workers Independent News has put worker voices and issues on hundreds of radio stations. But unless we raise enough money very quickly, that ends November 15th. So please go to laborradio.org and click donate now to save WIN. Madison, Wisconsin-based Workers Independent News was in the thick of the 2011 Wisconsin worker uprising that inspired the world. Inspire us now by saving Workers Independent News. Laborradio.org and click donate.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor, and I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Didn't it sound like he was actually surprised when he said he was running again? Didn't it sound like I am? Like he's trying to convince not the people in the audience, but actually himself? Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So as we were talking about earlier, the Corbett administration is saying, hey, look at all of these jobs the drillers created. Look at all of them, 203,000, even though 190,000 of them, according to his numbers, were well before he took office. So if you bought even the numbers that he's throwing out, he only created 13,000 jobs. Now, what he's saying is we've invested all this money, we've put all this money into the drillers, we've given them all this preferential treatment, all these special tax breaks, all of this stuff, we've given it all to them, and it's created 13,000 jobs. Why not go, to use Corbett math, let's invest in roads and bridges and transportation, and the number I saw is about $2.5 billion in investment in our infrastructure. And I use the number that Stephen La Tourette used to throw around, the Ohio Republican who retired last term, who said for every $1 billion of investment that you make in infrastructure, you create about 41,000 new jobs. $2.5 billion, you're looking at 100,000 jobs. We've got about 500,000 people unemployed in the Commonwealth. Easily, using Corbett math, we could easily wipe out every one of those. We get a zero unemployment, and he would be elected overwhelmingly. Because he would be then the more jobs governor, because more jobs, less taxes seemed to be his little plea, which makes me wonder why we're not going to see a transportation bill, which is why we've asked our good friend Abe Amoros, legislative director for Pennsylvania, for LIUNA to come talk to us. Abe, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome, Rick. Good to be with you.
So did you see the job numbers? 213,000 jobs, 203,000 jobs, the more jobs governor created.
Oh, my goodness. This has become the running joke, not just in Pennsylvania, Rick, but throughout the nation. You know, I was reading Politico.com this morning where I saw that, I mean, you know, he is one of two governors, the other one being from Maine, who is heavily being betted against in terms of keeping his seat next year. I mean, nobody's betting on the guy. And like you said at the top of the segment here, he sounded surprised that he was running for re-election. I got a real chuckle out of it, but I mean, this would be really sad, or really funny if it weren't so sad, because this guy's track record is slim. It is unstellar. He has absolutely no legislative accomplishments to point to. And Rick, I don't have any good news for you, man, on transportation. It doesn't seem as if they're making any kind of forward progress on it. And ironically, I was speaking to a legislator this evening who said to me, I feel bad getting paid because we're doing absolutely nothing. I have never heard a legislator be that frank with me, ever.
Wow.
In 21 years. And this guy actually felt badly that he was gating a salary, earning a salary, when there is absolutely nothing coming out of Harrisburg. So the legislative leaders met last week, and they talked some more about prevailing wage being part of the equation. There is not a single Democratic vote for prevailing wage. And what we learned last week was that three of the four legislative leaders are not interested in any bill that has prevailing wage in it. So the votes simply aren't there, Rick. I don't believe it's going to happen. And if nothing gets done by next Wednesday, a lot of them are saying that they're not going to come back in December. Now, that remains to be seen. But really, Rick, there are only three legislative days next week. And then in December, you have the Senate coming in the first week, just the Senate. In the second week, it'll be both chambers. And then in the third week, the House will be in for 2 days and then a non-voting session on that Wednesday. So it's not looking really optimistic right now in terms of a transportation bill. The Keystone Transportation Funding Coalition folks would disagree with me, saying, no, we're making progress because the discussions continue. But, of course, talk is really cheap in this town, Rick, until you see language, until you see a bill. Because Senate Bill 1, my friend, does not exist as we know it. There's no longer $2.5 billion on the table. It's now $2.3 billion, but there's nothing in writing. You know, unless we see a vehicle and it's passed on quickly, I don't have the optimism that I once did. I did back in September, thinking that the stars were going to align and people were going to take this seriously. But when they threw a monkey wrench into the mix with prevailing wage, that's really when they lost every single Democrat, and quite frankly, lost about a dozen labor-friendly Republicans, particularly from the Southeast. So when you combine that, Rick, with the fact that the Senate has absolutely no appetite to consider a transportation bill that has prevailing wage language in it, it's not looking very rosy. And unfortunately, that's going to translate into the fourth consecutive construction season that is going to be missed. And over 60,000 new jobs will not be created as a result of it. It's frustrating beyond belief. And unless an awful calamity transpires here in Pennsylvania, we're not going to get any legislative action in the near future. And I'm sorry to say that that's the only way I see that happening now, is if, heaven forbid, a school bus falls on a bridge and hurts or kills innocent people, especially children. It's just it's unbelievable.
It's sad that it might have to come to that. But, you know, I watched the governor, you know, go around the state and picking up chunks of concrete and saying, hey, you know, we've got this. And, you know, doing the dog and pony show like he really wanted to push it. I got to ask how sincere that is. And maybe you can gauge it, because, you know, I'm looking at this, and the guy, he's surprised he's running for re-election.
Yeah.
I don't know how you then run on more jobs, less taxes, when the more jobs that you're touting, not so much. And the less taxes, I think you lose that argument when you raise the gas tax by 28 cents.
That's exactly right. What he's doing is nothing more than cheap political posturing. This obviously coincides with election season. And one of the biggest criticisms that he's had, Rick, over the last several months is he's simply not engaged. And now he's engaging simply because, you know, he wants to keep his job in 2015. And of course, this also comes on the heels of well-placed conversations where the suggestion that we really shouldn't have Governor Corbett at the top of the ticket have taken place. I mean, those are real discussions, absolutely real discussions. And Congressman Jim Gerlach was approached, and Senator Pat Toomey was approached, and some other business leaders were asked their opinions as to whether or not they ought to dump the governor. So this is coming too late, too little. And like you said, I mean, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth. You know, he doesn't want to raise taxes, but now he's talking about the transportation bill, which obviously is going to increase taxes. So it's just a cheap political ploy. I didn't see a whole lot of traction on his announcements, Rick. I mean, the local media didn't go crazy. And quite frankly, when you're running for re-election, you don't need a statewide tour to reintroduce yourself to the voters if you're doing a good job, if you're doing the job that is required of you. But yet, this guy has chosen to go on a dog and pony show because his legislative record does not exist. His persona is weak as governor. Everyone that I talk to, Rick, says, oh, yeah, he's a nice fella, but, you know, he's just not up to the task of being governor. I mean, I hear this from Democrats and Republicans, and I hear this from elected officials who tell me, you know, the guy doesn't even work a Republican room. I mean, he'll be in a room with Republican legislators, and he won't schmooze them. He just walks in and ignores them, and you know, they take great umbrage to that because, you know, these guys all want to be loved, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Governor Corbett just doesn't seem to care that much. And when he goes out there and he has these pieces of concrete, I got to tell you, man, part of me is super, super offended because what he's doing is now he's using the transportation bill as a part of his platform. I mean, he's had 3 years to act on this with a Republican-controlled House, a Republican-controlled Senate, and a lot of, you know, I mean, this is a Republican-friendly town these days. And he still can't get it done. And now he's asking for 4 more years? Every working person in Harrisburg should be offended by that. Every working person in Pennsylvania should be offended by that. Because this guy simply doesn't care. And he doesn't get it either, which I think is worse.
Yeah, I find it interesting, though. You know, as you pointed out, you know, it's kind of like he's surprised he's running. But today, the big news that former Governor Tom Ridge and former shale lobbyist, Marcellus shale lobbyist Tom Ridge, has fully endorsed the governor. And, you know, as someone who's worked on campaigns and has done this a good portion of your life, is it odd this early to pull out someone like Ridge, this kind of an endorsement this far in advance of anything? Does that make any sense?
No, it doesn't. Well, I'll tell you what, it shows a lot of desperation. And if you're a Republican operative, it makes sense that you start getting the big guns out now, because that is a sign of desperation and really the sign of weakness, that you've got to pull your big cards out and your big guns out right away. I mean, this early, holy cow, man. I mean, I have not seen any kind of activity, especially for an incumbent this early. And, of course, the Republicans are famous for bonding together regardless of what happens. Unlike the Democrats, you know, we line up in a circle and then we pull out our pistols and we shoot each other. But, you know, this early, Rick, really surprises me. I would have understood a big announcement with Tom Ridge next fall, say September or October, but to see it this soon, I mean, it just shows a lot of desperation. And quite frankly, I mean, this is going to be forgotten about in a week anyway. I mean, we're talking about the holiday season and you know, John and Jane Doe voter, they're not really paying attention to the 2014 elections, you know, right before Thanksgiving.
I think I'm probably one of the only people I know who cares about the 2014 gubernatorial race.
You're probably right. I'll tell you, Rick. I mean, this is for them to do this so soon is very unusual. Very unusual.
I look at all of, if he's reelected, all of the horrible things that could happen. And look, I'm glad that the legislator you were talking to feels guilty about not doing any work. Cause I gotta be honest, other than the transportation bill, I'm glad nothing is getting done. Cause if they were to do anything, it would be bad. It would all be, it would be hocking off of our assets. It would be screwing up our school system. It would be screwing everything up. Cause look, these are the people who tell us they don't believe in government. No wonder. They muck it up and say, look, we told you.
You're absolutely right. So let's go down the scorecard once again. Privatization, he failed. Transportation bill, looks like he's going to fail. And public pension reform, Rick, off the table. No one's talking about that in Harrisburg now. When you watch the legislative sessions, you've got a bunch of meaningless bills that don't do a whole heck of a lot. And I shouldn't say meaningless. Obviously, they matter. But
yeah, matters. It matters that when two workers talk to each other, that's now going to be stalking. It matters when a local community says, we'd like to have paid sick day ordinance in our local community. No, that's illegal.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of pieces of legislation that are taking up time in our legislature.
Yeah, that part of it is garbage, absolute garbage. And when they're not naming bridges or renaming schools, they're out to screw the little guy, which is absolutely reprehensible. Absolutely reprehensible. And, the language is just getting stronger and stronger against working people, Rick. And we really need to hold our elected officials accountable towards that in 2014. I mean, it's going to get worse for us next year unless we really, really rally around workers, their rights, and creating jobs. I mean, every Democratic candidate better be banging that drum next year that job creation has to be number one in Pennsylvania, or they're not going to get my vote, I'll tell you that.
No, I'm with you. But I'm really sad to hear that that there'll be no investment anytime soon. But here's the reality. It's really not surprising since you look at the statistics just out. Right now, the U.S. has the least amount of investment per GDP that any time since World War II.
That's right, Rick. And that's tragic. And it's unnecessary because they have the resources, the tools, but they're lacking the political courage and the political will to get this done.
Yeah, that's right there. But sad, sad stuff. Abe, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate
Likewise.
The time.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Abe Amoros, Legislative Director for Pennsylvania for the Laborers International Union of North America. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Back to America. Rick Smith.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Jesse Woodson James would live only 34 years, but in that short period of time, he became a living legend. Jesse James was born in Clay County, Missouri in 1847 to a Baptist minister who made money as a hemp farmer. He had an older brother and a younger sister. When Jesse was three, his father gave in to the fever of the gold rush and left the family for California, where he soon died from disease that had spread throughout a community of prospectors. Jesse's mother remarried twice, and the second one worked out. Jesse's new stepfather was a doctor who moved into the James house, the only home Jesse ever knew growing up. One thing his father and stepfather had in common had a significant influence on young Jesse. His father had six slaves and his stepfather had seven. Join us again for the making of a Confederate outlaw. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Sometimes it pays just to go away. You could ask Jim Skinner about that. He was CEO of the hamburger behemoth McDonald's, pulling down a hefty $8.8 million in pay. Last year, though, Skinner retired. And rather than getting a gold watch, he was given a load of gold, so large that even a Brinks armored truck would have been too small to haul it all away. His salary of $753,000 was the least of it. The Big Mac chain also served up $1.7 million to the chief in stock and $3 million in option awards. Then it slathered on another $10.2 million in retirement pay. All that was topped by a super-rich dessert. $11.6 million in incentive pay. What? Why does a guy with millions already on his food tray need any incentive to do his job? Maybe because Skinner found it hard to stomach the biggest part of his job, which was to pay poverty wages to McDonald's 800,000 workers, shove thousands of them onto food stamps and other programs paid for by taxpayers, and lobby aggressively to prevent any increases in minimum wage or any tax hikes on uber-rich elites like him. It's dirty work, but Skinner did it, finally skipping away with a 2012 pay package totaling $27.7 million. Yet, in the phantasmagoric plutocracy of corporate land, too much is not enough. Last year, for the first time ever, the 10 highest-paid CEOs in America hauled in at least $100 million each, even as the great majority of workaday families have lost income. This is Jim Hightower saying, this gaping and ever-widening inequality is the greatest threat to our society's cohesion. Too few people now control an unconscionable and untenable share of America's money and power, using it to grab more of both for themselves. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
By working harder and working smarter, working with the employees in the Commonwealth, we made state government the smallest it has been in over 50 years. Promise kept.
We who have nothing, and most likely will too, we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christians, right-wing Republicans, straight white American man.
Promises kept. I love that. I go back to this. You know, who did he make the promise to? I don't remember that promise. I don't remember the promise. We're going to cut 20,000 education professionals. Do you remember that promise? I would love to hear someone say, yeah, Rick, you know, I was there when he looked me right in the eye and said, you know what? I'm going to cut 20,000 education professionals. I'm going to kick 41,000 people off of low-wage workers off of adult basic. That's what I'm going to do. That's my promise to you. My promise to you is I'm going to gut $3 billion in educational investment. That's my promise. I don't recall. And, you know, I got to ask, who do you make the promise to? Not you and me, not the people who work here for a living. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, podcast there, Stitcher, email rick@ricksmithshow.com. So, you know, we've been talking about free trade, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, free trade agreement coming down the road. At some point in the near future, they're negotiating behind closed doors, of course. I thought I would throw up, remember, I was completely against the Corus, the Panama, and the Colombian Free Trade Agreement. But here, another Colombian activist, union member, dead. A Nestle worker and union activist killed by paramilitary, operatives there in Western Colombia. He worked for, you know, Nestle for 25 years. Killed by an unnamed gunman. Unknown, unnamed. I have no idea what it is. Last Friday, several activists left messages and threatening texts saying, you still are bothering Nestle. Now there will be no more mercy. We're going to chop you up. Death to all communists of the union. And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, The push towards this free trade agreement by the right, by the business community, keeps telling me, you know, as a union supporter, as someone who believes in workers having rights on the job and having a voice on the job and being able to share in the wealth collectively earned, collectively gotten, there are forces in this country that I don't think are too far from this. And you go, well, that's a bit extreme, Rick. Nestle, isn't that an American company? Largest water company in the world. Think about the power that they have. The control that they have. We've given way too much power to these big companies. I'm telling you, it's absolutely mind-boggling. Now, you know, the transportation bill that Abe was talking about, first it started off, if you remember, going back to the Corbett Commission, where they had come up with their idea saying, look, you know, we need $3.5 billion. We need all of this investment. Laid it out very, very succinctly. It gathered dust on the shelf for a couple of years. And for every year, every day that it was on the shelf cost us $1 million each and every single day. And one of the provisions in there is this idea of public-private partnerships. And you see across the country, across the globe, really, this push towards getting private money and investing in the public good. And you go, well, wait a second. You know, this isn't the Eisenhower dream of having a mighty network of highways that span the entire country, that enhance our nation's economy, that enhance public safety, that enhance the national defense. Because one of the reasons, there's a belief that one of the reasons Eisenhower, and I think it was how he sold it, I don't think it was the sole purpose behind it. But one of the ways he sold it is, well, it's because we have to do everything in this country for national defense. It was a national defense thing. How we get our missiles from one place to another without connecting roads. So that's how the interstate highway system came about. Because, hey, we got to get our bombs around. I find it interesting. You know, I wonder what Eisenhower would think now when you look at, hey, we're going to allow you to bring your bombs through, but you're going to have to pay the for-profit company. Now, understand, you've got this ALEC-type legislation, the American Legislative Exchange Council's legislation for establishing P3s, the Private Property Public-Private Partnership Authority Act, which is a model piece of legislation that, look, we know that they basically handed out. And you got a bunch of you know, politicians who said, here's my homework. I did it. And turned it in without really caring, I don't think, about what's in it. What I find interesting is whoever buys your roads or your bridges, and we've talked about this numerous times in the past, they always put these non-compete clauses in. Like if we buy your parking garages, you can't use public transportation. You can't increase public transportation without us suing you because you're costing us money. If we buy your highway system or your turnpike, sorry, you can't do mass improvements to the roads around it. You can't add public transportation. You can't add other lanes. You can't do any of this other stuff because, of course, they have to make their money. And the people who keep pushing this stuff, you know, it's sad, but it seems to be bipartisan. It seems to be that we've bought this and we've swallowed this elixir that says, hey, the profiteers, they care. They care about our roads. Yeah, I love here in Harrisburg where they're still talking about privatizing the parking garages. And one of the first reports that came out said, you know, they're basically going to double everything. The rates, you know, the parking rates are going to go up. The fines are going to go up. The fees are going up. All of this stuff would go up. And I asked the question quite simply, you know, if they're all going to go up, why don't we just raise it, keep the money in the hands of the public coffer, and not give the asset away? Because we know what happens. Because they say, well, we're not buying it. We're just leasing it. I love that. We're just leasing it. So what's going to happen is they're going to use it for 50 or 90 years or whatever the lease is for, and then they're going to turn back over a steaming pile of you-know-what. And who's going to have to fix it? Oh, yeah, you, the taxpayer. Have we not seen this movie before? The answer is yes, we have. We've seen this movie over and over, but I guess we just would like to believe that it'll change. And what's frustrating is we're continually sold this idea that we need to privatize things. We need to cut taxes for the very wealthy because it'll trickle down to us. We need to build stadiums because it'll create jobs. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about an interesting situation in Atlanta. What I find hysterical about this is when they built, and this goes back to the 96 Olympics when they were building all of this stuff, one of the arguments for doing all this investment is that it would raise the conditions of the local economy. It would raise the conditions of the local neighborhoods and things would be better. But now you've got them saying, well, we have to move from where you built this stadium back in 96. We have to move out because, well, things haven't gotten any better. It's kind of maddening. Quick break, right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to Win
Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We cannot expect our economy to work when so many families are buying groceries with food stamps because we're not paid enough for our work. Walmart is paying hundreds and thousands of workers less than $25,000 a year. And to those who speak out about this, Walmart is a bully who tries to silence us.
Walmart worker Barbara Gertz. More than 50 workers were recently arrested in Los Angeles as Walmart workers went on strike for better wages, more hours, and the right to form a union without employer retaliation. The first Black Friday anniversary of the Walmart workers' strike actions is approaching, and workers like Los Angeles Walmart striker Anthony Goitia are more determined than ever to stand up and demand that Walmart pay living wages.
Even though more than 100 our Walmart members have been disciplined or outright fired by Walmart for speaking up, we're still standing up and we're still speaking out. My co-worker Carlson Smith worked for Walmart for 17 years and was fired for no other reason than being courageous enough to tell Walmart that workers have the right to speak out for things like better wages and better jobs. I'm putting my ability to feed my children on the line and taking this courageous act because I can't and won't wait any longer for Walmart and its illegal retaliation against those of us who have been calling for better wages and full-time work.
The U.S. Postal Service has reached a deal with Amazon.com to deliver the company's packages on Sundays. Jesse Russell reports.
Starting immediately, Sunday delivery of Amazon packages will start in Los Angeles and New York City greater metropolitan regions. In 2014, that will expand to other cities. The Postal Service has been losing money, mostly due to a congressional mandate requiring 75 years of retiree benefits be invested by 2016. Without that mandate, it has been projected that the service would have turned a profit this year. Saturday package delivery is more profitable for the service than first-class mail delivery. Sunday delivery will also give the Postal Service an advantage over businesses like UPS and FedEx, who currently don't service customers on Sundays. The Postal Service plans to negotiate Sunday delivery with other businesses in the online commerce sector.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender. Doing whatever it takes to meet your business lending needs for new construction, remodeling, or building training facilities. Online at bankoflabor.com.
I'm Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News. Since 2002, Workers Independent News has put worker voices and issues on hundreds of radio stations. But unless we raise enough money very quickly, that ends November 15th. So please go to laborradio.org and click donate now to save WIN. Madison, Wisconsin-based Workers Independent News was in the thick of the 2011 Wisconsin worker uprising that inspired the world. Inspire us now by saving Workers Independent News. Laborradio.org and click donate.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Life can be a challenge. Life can seem impossible. It's never easy when there's so much on the line. But you and I can make a difference.
Oh, Herman Cain, man. I miss Hermie. I really, you know, he was fun. A little off the wall, a little nuts, but fun. Now you find out he lives in probably one of the only privatized cities in the country, the Sandy Spring, Georgia, which is still in Fulton County, but really close to where they're talking about building the new Atlanta Braves baseball stadium in Cobb County, which I find interesting. The Cobb County Republican Party sent out a press release because there's some obvious outrage about the fact that they're leaving the city of Atlanta, moving to the suburbs. But the Cobb County GOP, in the highlighted portion that they highlighted themselves, said it's absolutely necessary. The solution is all about moving cars in and around Cobb and surrounding counties from north and east, where most Brave fans travel from, and not moving people into Cobb by rail from Atlanta. The other important part of the formula is for the citizens of Cobb not to experience any kind of tax increase. So what basically they're saying, what our good friends in the GOP in Cobb County, Georgia, are saying, we don't want those black people from the city coming to our suburbs, and we don't want to pay for the stadium. We don't want to pay for it. Seems very Republican. to me. Anyway, here to talk about the proposed stadium and the story and the outrage is our good friend Travis Waldron, reporter at Think Progress. Travis, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what do you think? We don't want those people in our neighborhood and we don't want to pay for it. So why are they building it there?
Well, that's exactly, I think, part of the problem with this is that, you know, you're building a stadium in a more affluent part of Atlanta, closer to, well, actually outside of Atlanta. They're going to say, you know, well, we have an Atlanta address, so it's still Atlanta. And you know, it's closer to the wealthier neighborhoods of Atlanta. It's in a county that's slightly wealthier than Fulton County, in a county that's much whiter than Fulton County. And, you know, this Republican position is kind of enlightening that, you know, this has been the Cobb County strategy since the 70s when they denied the public transit expansion. You know, not letting those people out there, and we all know what those people mean. And, you know, when you really think about it, I think that's one of the kind of silent tragedies of this stadium deal is not just the public financing. I think everybody, I've been on here before to talk about public financing and the pitfalls of that, but also just the fact of the lost access from people in Atlanta, lower income people, and, you know, yes, black people, minorities that are going to have less access to seeing baseball now. And I think that is, there's a social cost to that I think is really problematic, even above and beyond the financial cost of throwing $450 million to a baseball stadium at a time when, you know, Cobb County's cutting teachers and other services.
Yeah. Now, is the county paying for this? Because as I was reading through the Cobb County GOP statement, they made it sound like the county wasn't going to pick up the tab for anything and that they were going to keep fighting and make sure that the good Republicans there in that area didn't pay for it.
Yeah, so there's a lot of – that's kind of the sketchy details of this so far is, yeah, from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported that it's $450 million in public financing somehow, some way. How exactly that's going to be done is unclear, at least the last time I, you know, was reading up on it earlier today. It would seem that they're going to try to do it through existing taxes or existing revenue streams, because that would not require a vote, is right. My understanding, a public vote. Which obviously, as you know from following a lot of these situations, brings in a lot of concerns for the teams and the people who want these stadiums. You know, whether it's going to be done through like a hotel motel tax type deal, like the city of Atlanta is using for the Falcons Stadium, or through public bonds, as far as I can tell, isn't exactly clear yet. I'm sure we'll get more of that as this continues to unfold.
Yeah, but you know, I looked through this and as I was reading through the stories, you know, you pointed out a second ago that back in the 70s, you had a couple of these counties who they didn't want rail or public transportation because those people would come. I wonder when they build the stadium, who's going to work there if those people don't have transportation to get to and from the jobs that they had? And what's going to happen to the current workers who work at the stadium there now? What happens to them? And then how do you get workers to the facilities? Because I got to be honest, I don't think if you're moving to a very affluent area, I don't know that you're going to get any bankers and CEOs trying to pick up a couple of extra bucks on the weekend selling beer and peanuts at the ball game.
Right, that's a great point. And you know, if you follow along out in San Francisco, where the concession workers talked about going on strike earlier this year because their wages were so low, and they hadn't received a raise, you know, a lot of those workers have the same problem in that they can't afford to live in San Francisco on the money that they make working for the stadium and through other jobs. So they have to commute, you know, some of them for longer than an hour, 2 hours from places like Sacramento to get in. And I think that's a real concern here too, you know, is how are people going to get there and who are, you know, who's going to be working there? And are you, if you're paying these people a wage that is, you know, somewhere between minimum and livable, you know, is that really enough for them to make it out to Cobb County if they have to have a car, if they have to, you know, take other means that aren't public transit? And you know, there's so many dynamics to this that I think are exemplary of a lot of just the stratification that has gone on in sports, as I wrote about today, but also just, you know, kind of throughout society where different things are now accessible to different people. And that's okay because it just makes good business sense. And that's the justification that we use now is, well, this makes sense for the Braves from a bottom line perspective, so it's okay. But what about all of the other things, the social impacts, the impact on workers, you know, things like that? I think at some point those also have to be in the conversation as something to consider when making a move like this.
Absolutely. And, you know, I look at this and there's so many components to the business aspect of this. You know, the parking, because, hey, you could charge people 10, 20, 25 bucks to park their car instead of the buck or two that it would have cost to hop the train. When I grew up in Cleveland, we used to, you know, everybody parked in the suburbs who came down to the game, and you got on the rapid, the RTA, when the little train would take you down into the terminal, and you'd walk the couple blocks to the stadium, and, you know, you didn't have all the congestion and all the traffic, and if you did drive, you know, they socked you with parking. But, you know, hopping on the rapid took you right there. You were there in a couple of minutes. No traffic, no parking, none of that stuff. I see that as the perfect solution, but, you know, as we pointed out, they don't want that access to those people.
They don't. And, you know, one thing I think that should be clear here is that Turner Field, where the Braves play now, isn't exactly the most accessible place in the world. It's, you know, it's a kind of a sea of concrete around the stadium there. This wasn't exactly a well-designed plan when they moved from Fulton County Stadium to Turner Field in 1996. It was largely around the Olympics is how that was based, and it was kind of a compromise plan for the Braves wanted a new stadium. Atlanta had the Olympics. They built a new stadium and then converted it for the Braves. And a lot of the promises that were made at that time were never really fulfilled about, you know, this is going to be an accessible place. We're going to develop around it. And you know, the Braves were a large part of selling it that way, too. And now they're kind of using that justification. Well, the community didn't develop, and it's not accessible, so now we need to move somewhere else. And not only is it a better development opportunity for the people who are going to be making money here, but it's also less accessible.
Yeah, because there's no transportation to it. But, you know,
Right. Since
you brought up that angle, doesn't this then highlight the fact that all of the stuff that we've been told about building these behemoths is BS? Because we hear it all the time. If you build it, they will come. And then all of the businesses will prop up, and it will revitalize your downtown.
It is. Look, stadiums can be a part of economic development packages. They have been used and they have been done in a way that, you know, there is development around them. And people see that and they think, oh, well, stadiums are driving development. But really, it's not purely the case. A lot of times, you know, we put stadiums in places that we're going to develop anyway. And when you look at places where stadiums were supposed to drive development, you don't see that. And I think the Braves case is very, very indicative of that problem. You know, to say we're going to move into this neighborhood and it's going to help development, and less than 20 years later, we're going to move out of this neighborhood because there is no development, is kind of in and of itself a rebuke of all of the arguments, or at least the main arguments that people make about these massive public expenditures that really, you know, quite frankly, amount to very little more than public welfare or corporate welfare in most cases. You know, it's the team owners here in the Braves case, which is, I believe, a corporation, gets, you know, fairly wealthy, gets a lot of value off the team. The Braves' value is now up over $600 million. You know, they're not struggling. And they get a lot of the benefits, and the public generally gets left holding a large bag of debt.
Yeah, all the liability. You know, and I look at this, and, you know, a second ago you said that, you know, the folks who live in the neighborhoods around, and you know, those people who are not going to be able to go to the games out in the suburb. So could you make an argument that those folks aren't going to the games now? Because, look, I don't know about you, I took my kids to a professional game last year, and it was outrageous. I mean, I think 30 bucks a ticket. I don't know how many average, everyday working families can afford to take their kids to the ball game with any regularity. What I see, this is, you know, this is about the Herman Cains. This is about the very well-to-do, the people who have all of this disposable income. And maybe from a business model standpoint, they've outpriced all the rest of us that we can't go, so they're just going where the money's at.
Right. I call it today sort of the gentrification of professional sports, right, in that we are – not just where we're putting the stadiums, because that's kind of one issue, but also how we're doing things inside the stadiums. With the, you have this algorithm. I mean, the teams are pushing for more luxury suites because luxury suites bring more revenue, and they're raising ticket prices because that brings more revenue. And then, you know, if you've been to a baseball game or a football game or a basketball game, and you want to buy a beer or a soda or, you know, a hot dog, you're paying outrageous prices for it. And, you know, that's understandable. I think it's understandable from a business perspective, right? Like, these teams have the right to maximize their revenues. I think the question is like, sports teams, as I wrote today, have long been a kind of a common thread between lots of different types of people. And when you get into the idea that they're, you know, kind of stratifying different classes of people and being available to some people, but not to the entire community, I think that's problematic. I think there's a point where, you know, the business shouldn't trump everything. The quest for another dollar shouldn't trump everything in this idea. There should be, and I think there is, some real value to sports teams outside of the monetary value of them. And I don't know where the tipping point is where we realize that, and where these teams realize that maybe just being a part of the community is also valuable in a way that's not as tangible as what's on the bottom line. And at some point, I think either the teams or the public has to realize that. And, you know, until one side or the other does, we're just going to keep playing this game where, you know, the teams look around to different cities and different suburbs and different towns and find the one that'll give them the most money and build them the nicest stadium. And yet everybody wins except for the public, for one, the cities like Atlanta and also the people that just can no longer afford to be a part of this group that gets to enjoy it the same way as everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, you see these teams shaking down the local communities. It's outrageous. You know, I look at Minnesota. I look at a lot of these places. And I've always said that if tax dollars are into it, are being put into this, there's got to be some payback to the community. And I've often said, you know, maybe you got to give a percentage of your tickets to charity, or give a percentage of your tickets to low-income kids that may never get a chance to go to a football game, may never get a chance to actually experience. Because, look, I don't know how many people can afford $200 or $300 to take a family of four to a ball game. I just don't see
right. And let's be clear, it's not all just like individual team owners. It's the leagues are also
it's
largely responsible for this. You know, Bud Selig made it, the commissioner of baseball made it a goal to get nicer stadiums. And in the NFL, for instance, to access the NFL's loan program, your project, which gives you lower interest rates, I believe. You have to have, I think, a majority of the project has to be publicly funded. So this is not this isn't just one owner. This isn't just the owner of the Atlanta Braves or the owner of the Atlanta Falcons, because they're getting a new stadium too. This is something that starts at the top of the league. It's yep. something that a lot of politicians in these cities believe is a really good deal for their cities because it will generate growth. And it's something, you know, that also the politicians are hamstrung because no one wants to be the mayor or the city councilman that let the team leave, you know, because people like their team. But at some point, you know, somebody's got to stand up and say, we're getting fleeced here. And, you know, there's so much evidence now that you're getting fleeced. And until somebody stands up and realizes that, it's just going to keep going on, and it's just going to keep getting worse.
Fleeced. That's an F word. It's not the one I was thinking of, but it's an F word. I look at this.
It's a nicer. It's a politer.
It's radio friendly, but it's not the one I was thinking of. You look at this, and again, you know, it goes back to it's the public money that we could be spending much better. So, last question I've got for you: how's the local community there taking that? How are people taking it in Atlanta at this point, and what's being done to maybe change this?
Well, I think it's hard to tell because Cobb County and the Atlanta Braves kept this really quiet. They somehow managed to do this all, kind of strike this deal without anybody really knowing about it. You know, I think the public has been pretty, there's been some outrage against the Falcons stadium deal there, which actually, you know, could be much worse. The Falcons agreed to take over the overlays there, so it could be much worse. But there is I think you could expect to see people in the city of Atlanta really kind of question this and kind of say, you know, is this really our team anymore? Rember Brown at Grantland, who's a native Atlantan, wrote a really good piece about it and kind of said, you know, this is symbolic of a lot of the things that have happened in Atlanta, of people leaving, of people not wanting to be a part of the actual city's identity. And, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens going forward. I would be really surprised if there is a public outcry big enough to keep this from happening in Cobb County. I think there will probably be some excitement about, you know, having the Braves a little bit closer. But, you know, in Atlanta, I think this has to hurt, you know, and I say that as somebody who is, I am a Braves fan and grew up a Braves fan. I'm not from Georgia or Atlanta, but, you know, to see the team kind of say, you know, we don't need to be in the city anymore. We can be in the metro area. Even if it makes good business sense, it's kind of sad and it kind of just isn't the way that I would like to see it go down. And I think there are probably a lot of people in Atlanta who feel the same way.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm not a Braves fan, but I think it's a horrible thing, but it is what we do in this country. Travis, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Our good friend Travis Waldron, a reporter over at Think Progress, just insane. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
January of 1964 is a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement
created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of trucking deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who is willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that follow has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see a resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Claustrophobia, hypochondria, xenophobia, rolled up into one. Just saying, no car, saving mine, and we won't bother anyone. Cause I'm afraid of public transportation. Please don't get too close to me.
That seems to be what it is. I remember growing up in Cleveland. You'd get on the Rapid, and if you lived out in the suburbs or on the outskirts of the city, you'd get on the Rapid, you'd ride into the city, you'd walk over to the stadium. And I think Travis hit on something there a second ago, that it was people of all walks of life, and you were all kind of in the same situation, the same seating. You know, I remember Cleveland Municipal Stadium was this huge, this cavernous place where you could, for the opening day of the Indians, you could get 110,000 people into the stadium, crammed, standing room only, and you could get in and, sit in the bleachers. It was a buck and a half to get into the bleachers when I was, this is going back, 25, 30 years ago, but it was a buck and a half to get into the game. Those seats, long gone. Trust me, long, long, long gone. The idea that you're going to be able to get in I've gone to a bunch of games over the years where most of the seats are empty. And you got to ask yourself, what benefit is keeping the tickets at $25, $30, $50? Well, because some people will pay it. And, and putting the stadiums way out in the middle of nowhere, Cleveland put the Coliseum out in the middle of, they called it the White Elephant. It was out in the middle of nowhere. And you wondered why the Cleveland Barons failed, because nobody trekked out there. This is just another example of we're pandering to the very well-to-do, pandering to the very wealthy. This is part of why I think a lot of like me, I've kind of walked away from watching a lot of the sports. I'll watch football on TV and all that, but it's not like it was. I guess I'm just a little nostalgic. Anyway, gotta take a quick break. Right back with hour three. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We cannot expect our economy to work when so many families are buying groceries with food stamps because we're not paid enough for our work. Walmart is paying hundreds and thousands of workers less than $25,000 a year. And to those who speak out about this, Walmart is a bully who tries to silence us.
Walmart worker Barbara Gertz. More than 50 workers were recently arrested in Los Angeles as Walmart workers went on strike for better wages, more hours, and the right to form a union without employer retaliation. The first Black Friday anniversary of the Walmart workers' strike actions is approaching, and workers like Los Angeles Walmart striker Anthony Goitia are more determined than ever to stand up and demand that Walmart pay living wages.
Even though more than 100 our Walmart members have been disciplined or outright fired by Walmart for speaking up, we're still standing up and we're still speaking out. My coworker Carlson Smith worked for Walmart for 17 years and was fired for no other reason than being courageous enough to tell Walmart that workers have the right to speak out for things like better wages and better jobs. I'm putting my ability to feed my children on the line and taking this courageous act because I can't and won't wait any longer for Walmart and its illegal retaliation against those of us who have been calling for better wages and full-time work.
The U.S. Postal Service has reached a deal with Amazon.com to deliver the company's packages on Sundays. Jesse Russell reports.
Starting immediately, Sunday delivery of Amazon packages will start in Los Angeles and New York City greater metropolitan regions. In 2014, that will expand to other cities. The Postal Service has been losing money mostly due to a congressional mandate requiring 75 years of retiree benefits be invested by 2016. Without that mandate, it has been projected that the service would have turned a profit this year. Saturday package delivery is more profitable for the service than first-class mail delivery. Sunday delivery will also give the Postal Service an advantage over businesses like UPS and FedEx, who currently don't service customers on Sundays. The Postal Service plans to negotiate Sunday delivery with other businesses in the online commerce sector.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender. Doing whatever it takes to meet your business lending needs for new construction, remodeling, or building training facilities. Online at bankoflabor.com.
I'm Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News. Since 2002, Workers Independent News has put worker voices and issues on hundreds of radio stations. But unless we raise enough money very quickly, that ends November 15th. So please go to laborradio.org and click donate now to save WIN. Madison, Wisconsin-based Workers Independent News was in the thick of the 2011 Wisconsin worker uprising that inspired the world. Inspire us now by saving Workers Independent News. Laborradio.org and click donate.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Gotta wonder, what's Little Willie doing coming out and saying that Obama should let people keep their health care plans? And look, I'm there's part of me that goes, I'm in favor of it. But Bill Clinton came out today and said, I personally believe, even if it takes a change in the law, the president should keep honor the commitment the federal government made to those people and let them keep what they've got. Evidently, he was interviewed by OZY, and the White House came out and said, well, you know, Jay Carney said that, you know, the president and Clinton agree on the issue. So what does that mean? And I know that the White House is trying to, you know, they're trying to you know, fiddle around the edges. They're trying to add little caveats here and there where they can. Now, what they said is, if you had one of these plans before the Affordable Care Act came into law and you really liked that plan, what we said was, is you could keep it if it hasn't changed since the law passed. Again, I don't remember the caveat. I remember you like it, you keep it. Because it was simple, it was sloganeering, and maybe that's what he meant to say. Maybe he meant to say it, but I remember this is what happens when you get into bumper stick politics. When you get into sloganeering, or if you like it, you keep it. And everyone goes, oh, I can? I can keep my crappy plan that has really high deductibles and high copays and doesn't really cover anything when I need anything and gives me denials. I can keep that. Oh, boy, thank goodness. Thank goodness I can keep the thing that when I get sick, I go bankrupt. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Oh, thank you so much. I just appreciate it so very much. And what I find interesting is you've got all these people running around saying, well, they canceled my plan and I liked it. It's because you never used it. Now, Clinton went into a story about he met a young person. And this is, I don't know if it's anecdotal. I don't know if he actually met somebody who told him this. And I don't know why you would repeat it without being able to verify it. But either way, there was I'm sure there was a reason behind this. He said he met a young person who had one of these plans that had high deductibles and had high copays, but he was happy with it. And he went and he looked at the new plans, and his premium went up. But of course, the deductibles and copays were lower. The coverage was better, but you know, he's like, "Wait, I don't need all that. You know, if I get sick, then yeah, I will have saved money, but." What if I don't get sick? And this is the problem with this. And this is where we should have had that conversation all along from the beginning by saying, you know what? Kind of like we do with car insurance at some point. Saying, look, you've got to be financially liable for yourself. We're not going to be writing things off as we do. We're not going to be passing those costs. And for me, that's what it comes down to. It comes down to saying, look, we're going to get everybody covered one way or another. I preferred from the beginning Medicare for all. I preferred opening that up saying, you know, much like this, the exchanges. I don't know why we needed the states to set up the exchanges. I don't know why we had to go to Tom Corbett and to Scott Walker and to Rick Scott and to Rick Snyder and to all of these Republican governors and the Chris Christies and the Rick Perrys. I don't know why we needed to go to them and say, oh, would you please set up an exchange in your state? Because if you don't, everything will collapse. I don't know why we needed to do that. You had a nationwide network already in place. You had an exchange system right there. It was called Medicare. And I said, right day one, and day one, I said, the simple solution to this, the very simple, the most basic, simplistic, because Republicans love bumper stickers. They love bumper sticker politics. It would have been so easy to put Medicare for All on a bumper sticker. It would have fit, too. And you could have seen it from, you know, down the road a little ways. Affix a price to it, much like any insurance company does. Use your actuarial tables, you know, because we got to hire actuaries. And look, they need jobs, and I'm okay with that. But have your tables, have your actuaries say, okay, well, just like we would do with any insurance, we're going to compete. We're going to put Medicare in the direct competition with the big insurance companies. Now, I don't think the big insurance companies would have liked that. And it's not what we ended up with. But that would have been the simple version. And, you know, since the right loves to tell us competition, maybe the two plans would have competed directly with each other instead of having a bunch that confuse and muddle. Maybe they would have actually competed. And maybe you would have said, hey, you know, we're going to make things a little bit better. And we're going to drive down costs. But that's not what happened. And not even from the beginning, and this is what infuriates me, not even from the beginning was that ever an option. It was never even discussed as a potential option. And I hear people say, well, you know, they rammed that law down our throat. I go, an entire year? My frustration with the healthcare law, and there are many. One, it's fairly complicated. We have now put insurance and signing up for it into the hands of people who, you know, it's not their thing. They're not masters of the internet. And then you throw this, look, I'm not internet savvy whatsoever. So you're going to make me go to a website that doesn't really work well because you had 55 for-profit companies all with their fingers in this, all doing something different, all trying to figure out how to do this. And understand the reason for this. the reason that you had 55 for-profit companies doing it is because our government can't. And that's a sad testament. Our government can't because we've had a massive brain drain. We have had a massive assault on we the people, on the public good. We have had a massive assault. And when Tom Corbett runs around saying, oh, I've made state government smaller than it's ever been, what he's done, he's talking about a brain drain. He hasn't invested in new technology to run things better. They're just content to let things slowly deteriorate, slowly break down. Until at some point, you get where we're at now with the federal government. I don't know that they could have actually done healthcare.gov. Given the structure right now, given the technological situation, I don't know that they could have. Because we've starved the beast. The beast is ripe for drowning. Understand that. Our government is ripe for drowning. And what we see all the time is these congressional Republicans showing us, see, look, I can dunk your head underwater. And every time they hold the country hostage, every time they have one of their tizzy fits, every time they pull the shenanigans like they did with the shutdown that cost us billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of jobs, every time it happens, we get a little weaker. And they go, that's good. So when you look at the healthcare situation, we've put it all into the hands of profiteers. We've put it all into the hands of for-profit corporations. We've put it all into the hands of people outside of our control. And we're surprised when it didn't work. Now remember the frame. The profiteers do it better. The private market does it better. Always does it better. I point to healthcare.gov. That's the private market in action. And I know, oh, no, Rick, you see, there was that person over at the Center for Medicare Services that, you know, they changed it, and it was, you know, it was bad. And them, 55 for-profit corporations. And not one person said, hey, I don't know that this is going to work, until it actually went. Look, I am not a computer genius. I'm not even a novice. But there are some things that just on a certain level you go, it's common sense that, you know, if you came to me and said, you know, whatever it is, let's say we're driving a truck and you got five people driving the truck. At some point, one of the five guys driving it have to tell you that one of the wheels is flat, right? Don't you think? Wouldn't you think at some point that somebody would go, hey, you know, one of the grommets are leaking air. Maybe we should fix that. Don't you think? Same thing with this. At some point, and as I watched the testimony, and it's one of those things that really grabbed my attention, as you watched the testimony of these company representatives who were all saying, well, our part of it worked perfectly well. Our part worked perfectly fine. It was, you know, and basically pointing fingers everywhere else. Nobody stepped up and said, well, you know, I did it. Doesn't it just seem a little odd? Doesn't it seem a little strange to you? So you got Willie who jumps into the middle of this jackpot saying that, you know, people should keep it. And on its face, I say, you know, maybe people should be able to, keep it because Obama said so. But here's my problem with it, because I do believe that these crummy micro plans and these crummy plans that leave people exposed have to be done away with. What happens when you decide and you choose? And this is my problem. What happens when you choose to keep that crummy plan? What happens when you choose to say, you know what, I'm going to keep the high deductible, high copay plan that only covers certain things, doesn't cover all the preventative care, all of the things that are mandated by the law? because you promised me I could keep the crummy plan I have because I like it because it's cheap. And it gives me this sense of security. Granted, it's a false sense of security, but I feel okay. I feel okay with it. I chose it. I like it. I'm married to it. I'm going to keep it. Then you get sick. Then the bills start rolling in. And the bills keep rolling in. And the bills keep rolling in and keep rolling in and keep rolling in until the fact that you are buried. And I've talked to so many people that this has happened to, that they thought, hey, I have insurance. I'm going to be okay. Now you're buried in debt. Now you're looking at losing your home. You're looking at losing your savings. You're looking at losing your family. Now you're talking about, hey, not so much getting better, not so much healing, getting well, not so much taking care of yourself, but now I got to protect my family from disaster. It's no longer about getting well. It's about getting water out of the boat that's sinking. What happens when that happens? Do we allow folks who, hey, I liked my plan, I got to keep it, but it was crummy, do we allow them to sink? And at some point, do we say no bankruptcy for you? Sorry, you have to pay it, even if it takes you an eternity? Because I got to be honest, medical bankruptcies account for the vast majority of bankruptcies for working people in this country. Should we not be going, sorry, no more medical bankruptcies? Everybody should have adequate coverage. Just a thought. But I'm interested. I'm interested to see where the other shoe falls. I don't know that little Willie jumps into the middle of the jackpot without somebody saying, hey, let's float this trial balloon. Let's see where this goes. So it'll be interesting to see in the coming days where this takes us. But I find it interesting that Jay Carney says that the White House and Obama are on, or the White House and little Willie are on the same team. So, interesting. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Up the top.
We gotta get organized. We gotta do it today. No more madness than fools. No more victory.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Sometimes it pays just to go away. You could ask Jim Skinner about that. He was CEO of the hamburger behemoth McDonald's, pulling down a hefty $8.8 million in pay. Last year, though, Skinner retired, and rather than getting a gold watch, he was given a load of gold, so large that even a Brinks armored truck would have been too small to haul it all away. His salary of $753,000 was the least of it. The Big Mac chain also served up $1.7 million to the chief in stock and $3 million in option awards. Then it slathered on another $10.2 million in retirement pay. All that was topped by a super-rich dessert, $11.6 million in incentive pay. What? Why does a guy with millions already on his food tray need any incentive to do his job? Maybe because Skinner found it hard to stomach the biggest part of his job, which was to pay poverty wages to McDonald's 800,000 workers, shove thousands of them onto food stamps and other programs paid for by taxpayers, and lobby aggressively to prevent any increases in minimum wage or any tax hikes on uber-rich elites like him. It's dirty work, but Skinner did it, finally skipping away with a 2012 pay package totaling $27.7 million. Yet, in the phantasmagoric plutocracy of corporate land, too much is not enough. Last year, for the first time ever, the 10 highest-paid CEOs in America hauled in at least $100 million each, even as the great majority of workaday families have lost income. This is Jim Hightower saying, this gaping and ever-widening inequality is the greatest threat to our society's cohesion. Too few people now control an unconscionable and untenable share of America's money and power, using it to grab more of both for themselves.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. So you may remember, we talked about the forced anal probing, the colonoscopy, in New Mexico. And I gotta be honest, when we went on the People's Tour for America, one of the cities we were gonna stop in was Silver City, New Mexico, where evidently this is where the guy ended up, because they had taken this guy who pulled out of the Walmart parking lot, was stopped by the police there, and allegedly was clenching his buttocks. I can't make this up. That's what the report says. He was clenching his buttocks. Maybe he had to go. Who knows? But that was probable cause. Thought he had drugs. Took him to a hospital. The hospital says, that would be unethical. We can't do that. So the police took him to another hospital outside of the jurisdiction and the county of where the warrant was issued. And look, they got a search warrant because he was clenching his buttocks. And that's all it's got to take, I guess, anymore, for a judge to say, hey, might be having drugs up there. Let's check it out. He endured, yes, I think it was five or six of these probes, some x-rays. They started, I guess, with an x-ray. And then they did several of the anal probes. They did an enema and forced defecation, and they found no drugs. One procedure after another, after another, after another, and then they finally drugged him, sedated him, and did a colonoscopy. The kicker to this, and this is where, you know, the whole healthcare law really comes into effect. Now, think about this for a second. What if you don't have health insurance? And you're driving through Silver City, New Mexico. You get pulled over for clenching your little hiney cheeks. They go, they probe you several times, drug you, colonoscopy. I wonder if the guy got the results. I guess he would have to, because they're now charging him. The hospital has sent him a bill for all of the procedures. You can't make this stuff up. They're now charging him for all of the procedures. And it comes down to, what's interesting is it comes down to a dog, their drug-sniffing dog. I don't know how to put this gently. You ever seen like a German Shepherd or like a Rottweiler, or a big dog who's right about that height, who just seems to love to stick his nose right there? Seemed that the dog liked that smell, the smell of, you know, what's behind. Gave the indication that that smell was the drug smell. It turns out the guy who filed the lawsuit, this David Eckert, he's not the only one that has been probed. We now find that a third New Mexico restaurant, resident, is suing law enforcement because, well, went through the same thing. You've got this woman now who is filing, based on her, the federal agents and doctors, violated her civil rights because she was stopped at the border crossing in Juarez, Mexico, into El Paso. She is now suing because the drug-sniffing dog went and sniffed her, you know where. They made the woman undress. They made her go through the whole things. They probed her. They did all of that stuff then. Took the woman to the University Medical Center in El Paso and, well, went through a whole bunch of stuff. X-ray, the whole laxative thing, the whole forced that. Then the probes, the cavity search, the probes, all the stuff. They said... they probed, the front and the back. They described in the medical records as bimanual. And bimanual means both two-handed. So you got one in the front, one in the back. They did a CT scan and found nothing. So then you go, hold on. who pays for this? And I'm waiting to find out, and I got to find out if they're going to bill her. Now, the ACLU says the federal agents never obtained a search warrant before doing this, and she refused to consent. So no one knows who she is because she's saying she's the victim of sexual assault. And you got to go at some point. Don't we have to start looking in? Isn't an X-ray enough? Honestly, I mean, when you do the X-ray, you can see that, there's not a huge condom full of drugs there. So, I mean, that stuff kind of pops up. Don't you think? Do you have to do all of the other things? And there's part of me that thinks there are some sadistic folks among us who just enjoy this. I don't know that I want them over for Thanksgiving dinner, to be honest. Wow. But I got to find out if they're going to have to pay the healthcare costs. Have you been following the war on Christmas? Evidently, Sarah Palin's back, pimping the war on Christmas. And, of course, there's the war on Thanksgiving, which is an actual war. What the conservatives are saying, well, you won't say Merry Christmas. There's a war on Christmas. The war on Thanksgiving is really, really very real. At some point, there'll be no Thanksgiving. Now we've, over the past several days, a number of these big retailers, Toys R Us, JCPenney's, Kohl's, Macy's, Kmart, Best Buy, Target, all of them have come out and said, you know what? We're gonna open our stores, Thanksgiving night. Now Walmart has come out and said they're gonna open up at 6 p.m. On Thanksgiving night. Because, everyone's done eating by 6 o'clock, right? Because we need to get that push to the big holiday. And Kmart is going to open on Thanksgiving Day at 6 a.m. So they're going to be open all day. And how long is it going to take before the rest of them go, Kmart's beating us to the people who want, the nothing because there are no sales yet. What is wrong with us? I mean, I understand there's a number of, maybe this is union busting. Maybe they think that, there's going to be a wave of strike activity of workers saying, we're not working Black Friday. Maybe they're going, fine, don't work Black Friday. We'll make it to Black Thursday. I loved the response from Walmart's chief marketing officer. He was asked about the move to 6 o'clock. And he said almost everybody to date has moved up at least 1 hour, if not more. Talking about the different companies, the Best Buys, the Macy's, the Kohl's, the JCPenney's, all of those. The chief marketing officer at Walmart said, we thought 6 o'clock was the exact right time to win the weekend. And then he went on to explain that the 1 million workers who would be working that day, the 1 million workers who would be needed to staff the stores, that they were really excited to work that day. And I'm going, really? Did you pull Did you test all of your workers? Did you say, you know, hey, workers, are you thrilled about working on Thanksgiving Day when you should be spending time with your family, when you should be home, you know, like the American tradition of being bloated on the couch watching bad football? But no, they're really excited. And I wonder, do they get paid overtime? Because I remember, and I guess it's just me being kind of getting a little older, I remember as a younger man, the department store that would be open on any of the federal holidays, that it was double time pay plus the day's holiday. So it was actually triple time. The incentive wasn't there to be open so that you could spend time with your family. Now, these were family values. Understand that. I truly believe I am truly the family values man. I think holidays should be spent with family. I think birthdays, people should have those off so they can celebrate and be with their family. I'm a huge, huge supporter of a lot of this stuff. This is a horrible idea. Now, look, you know, Thanksgiving is one of those few holidays that I think actually still has something of a family component to it. But here what we've done is earlier and earlier and earlier in the year, what is it? Eventually it's going to be Thanksgiving. It's going to be Halloween, and we're going to be, we're starting the holiday. Yeah, well, we are. I saw Christmas decorations near the middle of October. Really? So I have a theory. Maybe what we do is we have the retail sector, much like they did with Christmas, come up with a summer holiday. We have a summer buying holiday, much like a Christmas light. So that twice a year we have this, and then we shorten the seasons. So instead of it being from the end of October all the way through November, all the way through December, well, we do it, we say Thanksgiving, the Monday after Thanksgiving, like hunting season, the Monday after Thanksgiving, then you can start looking to Christmas. And maybe a couple of weeks in July we'll have a run-up to a big holiday there where everything shuts down and people get to spend a little time knowing the people that live under their roofs. Does that sound like a good idea? Instead of having people who are really excited to work on the holiday and be taken away from their families, saying, you know what? It's not really all about the big box retailers. It's not really all about the race to the bottom. It's not really all about, can we make the sale today? It's really about the people who live in our homes, the people that we care about. You don't hear politicians talk like that. And you certainly don't hear big business thinking like that. I'll tell you one thing. I will not be going anywhere near one of these places on Thursday. I most certainly will not be going anywhere near one of these places on Friday. Saturday I may. I'm a big fan of Small Business Saturday. But you won't see me anywhere on Thursday or Friday. I will be home with my family on that day. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to Rick Smith Show.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We cannot expect our economy to work when so many families are buying groceries with food stamps because we're not paid enough for our work. Walmart is paying hundreds and thousands of workers less than $25,000 a year. And to those who speak out about this, Walmart is a bully who tries to silence us.
Walmart worker Barbara Gertz. More than 50 workers were recently arrested in Los Angeles as Walmart workers
workers went on strike for better wages, more hours, and the right to form a union without employer retaliation. The first Black Friday anniversary of the Walmart workers' strike actions is approaching, and workers like Los Angeles Walmart striker Anthony Goitia are more determined than ever to stand up and demand that Walmart pay living wages.
Even though more than 100 our Walmart members have been disciplined or outright fired by Walmart for speaking up, we're still standing up and we're still speaking out. My co-worker Carlson Smith worked for Walmart for 17 years and was fired for no other reason than being courageous enough to tell Walmart that workers have the right to speak out for things like better wages and better jobs. I'm putting my ability to feed my children on the line and taking this courageous act because I can't and won't wait any longer for Walmart to end its illegal retaliation against those of us who have been calling for better wages and full-time work.
The U.S. Postal Service has reached a deal with Amazon.com to deliver the company's packages on Sundays. Jesse Russell reports.
Starting immediately, Sunday delivery of Amazon packages will start in Los Angeles and New York City greater metropolitan regions. In 2014, that will expand to other cities. The Postal Service has been losing money mostly due to a congressional mandate requiring 75 years of retiree benefits be invested by 2016. Without that mandate, it has been projected that the service would have turned a profit this year. Saturday package delivery is more profitable for the service than first-class mail delivery. Sunday delivery will also give the Postal Service an advantage over businesses like UPS and FedEx, who currently don't service customers on Sundays. The Postal Service plans to negotiate Sunday delivery with other businesses in the online commerce sector.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender. Doing whatever it takes to meet your business lending needs for new construction, remodeling, or building training facilities. Online at bankoflabor.com.
I'm Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News. Since 2002, Workers Independent News has put worker voices and issues on hundreds of radio stations. But unless we raise enough money very quickly, that ends November 15th. So please go to laborradio.org and click donate now to save when. Madison, Wisconsin-based Workers Independent News was in the thick of the 2011 Wisconsin worker uprising that inspired the world. Inspire us now by saving Workers Independent News. Laborradio.org and click donate.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Remember all of that talk about the timetables and withdrawal? And, you know, if we set a deadline, it would give the enemy something to look forward to. Remember all that the Republican chest thumping and saying, oh, it's never been done in history, and we can't possibly because the terrorists will win. Today, back in 1972, Nixon set a new deadline for the next troop withdrawal. Set it for February 1st, 1972. A little bit further down the road, saying we'll take about 45,000 more troops out, and the drawdown will continue. Never been done. Never been done in history. Just kind of makes me scratch my head and go, well, history is something we've completely forgotten in this country. Anyway, let's go to Washington, D.C., find out what's going on there and around the world. I've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much.
So, you know, could never set a timetable, never a date, never withdraw, because, of course, the terrorists would win, right?
Right.
And here,
but that's what they want.
Yeah. Here, Tricky Dick, did it back. Well, it doesn't matter. What did you think of Bill Clinton's statement?
I was really quite shocked. And I know you and I talked a little bit off air about the fact that it was kind of a setup for him. I don't know. I don't know. As one of the Washington pundits said, he went off message big time. And that did happen to be, because I've covered the White House since Bill Clinton became president in 93, but I have to tell you that it's very rare, if not, that Clinton did not go off message. He was known for going off message, and it used to drive his people completely nuts that he could never, you know, they would sort of set up a policy, and Bill Clinton would just say something different.
Yeah.
And then everybody would be scrambling. I remember when he left office, we all at the press corps said, we're never going to enjoy 8 years the way we've enjoyed these 8 years.
Because, you know, the one thing I give Bush credit for is George W. Bush could stay on message. Not that I don't think there was much else in there, but I do believe that, you know, once they gave him his marching orders, I thought he stayed on message.
He was always on message. I don't think that he went off the ranch ever.
Both figuratively and literally.
Yes.
They spent a lot of time. I wonder how much brush the former president has cleared since he left office.
I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but I'm very mixed about George Bush since he left the presidency. I, of course, never liked anything he did when he was president, almost. But since he's been president, he's actually made a huge difference in Africa.
And
he's beloved in Africa.
I'm sure he is, and I'm sure, you know, his foundation is doing some great work. But, you know, I go back and I think of all of the damage.
Although he did do the PEPFAR program when he was president. I do want to clarify that.
And that was one of the things that they put a huge display in his museum there. But I'm sorry, all of the other stuff.
That's right, you went to his museum.
Yeah, I went to his library. All of the other stuff, I don't know. I'm not going there with you. But I am curious how much brush he's cleared since, because, you know, he used to do an awful lot of brush clearing when he was president.
He certainly did.
Had a lot of calluses on those hands during that time. Kind of makes you wonder. But, you know, going back to the Clinton statement, Jay Carney was asked if Obama and Clinton were in agreement in the issue, and Carney said the answer is yes. The president has tasked his team with looking at a range of options, as he said, to make sure that nobody is put in a position where their plans have been canceled and they can't afford a better plan, even though they liked the one they had better. So there's part of me that goes, they're throwing him out there going, okay, well, let's see what they'll buy next. Let's see if we can soften. Let's see what the polls, all that. I like to think that at least there's some planning. Maybe there's not. Maybe you're right. Maybe, you know, with Clinton, maybe things are not. Maybe that was just spin control after the fact.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's unexplainable. But I do know that the president is not paying much attention to it. And they are just focusing on trying to get this problem fixed, or the problems associated with the site fixed. So I do know that that is really where they're focused. The president is going to Cleveland, Ohio on Thursday. And so that is going to be pretty big on that front.
Yeah, I mean, a huge, you know, my hometown, a lot of people need it. I mean, you got to get out, and I understand the president and the vice president are going to be hitting the road doing the tour to, you know, promote, you know, their policy agendas. And for me, you've got to get out there because the 24-hour news cycle is just bashing this health care law. And look, rightly so, there are some things that need to be looked at and beat up on. It's just the way I see it.
Right. Well, I got to tell you, I think America needs to focus not on the website, which are not good, but what could come out of this if it works.
Yeah, I understand the whole don't throw away the possible with the perfect, but I still go back to the whole public option at the minimum. Medicare.
Well, I mean, I think where he made a mistake is he didn't have the guts to say, let everybody buy into Medicare.
No, I don't think he had the guts to say, this is my plan. I think he saw what Clinton did, and everybody bashed it and him. And, you know, the whole sausage-making process is what took over, and we ended up with basically the Romney plan with a different label on it.
Well, in fact, not only did we wind up with a Romney plan with a different label in many respects, but I was at the Family USA conference, and we interviewed a guy who was at MIT who helped write the Massachusetts plan, and he helped write the Obama plan. So, yes, same plan.
Yeah. I mean, and you go back to the 90s when Clinton put out his plan, this is what they were touting at the time, and it just blows my mind that how far Republicans have gone to, I can't even say to the extreme right, but just some weirdo land that, you know, they were supposedly the party of personal responsibility, but personal responsibility, not something they're willing to stand for. Because I got to be honest, I think if you make it affordable, you make it possible, everyone should have it to protect themselves. It's just that simple.
Yes, very much so. In fact, as I said, I was just over at my friend's house, whose husband just died, and he was 80 but still teaching at a university, and she didn't even know what to do. What does she do? Can she? She'd never heard of COBRA, and I talked about Medicare. It was like a shock to her.
Yeah, but, you know, Medicare should be there. I mean, I shouldn't have to worry about COBRA, right? I mean, unless
he was
very lucky.
But she had COBRA under his policy. I mean, she didn't really understand it. And if somebody who's pretty educated, like she doesn't understand it, how's everybody else going to understand?
And I think about my grandmother, you know, when she went through, you know, getting into Medicare and all that, it was a difficult thing. And fortunately, there was someone there to help her along. And sadly, what I see in this is not people who are going to be there to help along. In fact, we're seeing tons of reports of there now being fraudulent help, if you will, and not healthcare.gov, but healthcare.com and other spinoffs and runoffs. And looks official, sounds official, not so much official.
Well, that is a big problem that they are having with the scammers.
And, you know, I look at this and it's not making it any easier, which is why I go back to my original thought. We should have never broken down the unemployment offices. We should have never broken down the welfare offices. We should have never destroyed the places where people went. I understand we did it for they say, cost savings, but more so we keep those people separate. But we should have never broken up those offices where people actually went to, sat down, filled out a piece of paper, or, you know, played on the computer and did it online, but actually went somewhere and did it. I'm a firm believer in having those offices and having a place that, you know, this is it. This is the place you go.
And also where people talk to a live human being.
Absolutely. And you know what we could do then? We could create jobs and we could lower that unemployment rate. But no. That would mean we would have to tax somebody. Sad stuff. Anyway, I understand the merger between U.S. and American is going to be going forward.
It looks like it's going to be going forward. They're putting some caveats on it. It will be the world's largest airline. As you know, there was a precedent that when United merged with Continental. And so that was a precedent that was definitely set. However, this is going to be a lot larger. What it'll mean is there's going to be less competition. And what happens when people lose their jobs? And a lot of these are union employees.
Yep.
Good question.
No. I mean, we love monopoly, don't we? Too big to fail is a wonderful thing, right? Look at the banks.
And higher ticket prices.
Look at the banks. Too big to fail is a wonderful
right.
thing. So what happens down the road when they're too big to fail? When they're the monopoly.
When they're too big to fail and they fail, that's a very good question.
Well, what happens? Who bails them out?
Yep. Well. Let's hope it's not like the car company.
Well, I got to be honest, the one thing I give Obama credit for, and I don't give him an awful lot of credit for much, but I give him credit for not sticking it to those employees like Romney would have. They got to save some of their pensions, which one of the first times in history, I think, where a company went through bankruptcy and the workers weren't the first to get screwed. So at least a little credit to him on that.
Well, that's true, and that's good.
Yeah. Also, lastly, negotiations going on with Iran. Last week there was some hope a deal would be made. So over the weekend, failed. Where are we now?
Yes. Well, it's interesting. There's people like Trita Parsi, who is Iranian and has been working on this issue for a very long period of time. He said that there are definitely some things worth saving and that we're part of this. Now the question is, can there be anything that goes either through the United Nations or Singularity? And we just don't know. I think that Secretary Kerry, I guess he's not a senator anymore, is going to talk, and I believe he might even be testifying this week about this. So, and I don't know whether the testimony is behind closed doors or whether it's at least I'm sure part of it is going to be behind closed doors. So we're not going to know everything, but this was not good.
No, it's not good. And look, I mean, conceptually, I mean, I don't think it's going to work anyway, because there's no way of verifying. I mean, every time you turn around, you're finding something new. And what's if you're giving them this carrot of, you know, we're going to lower sanctions and we're going to, you know, open up the floodgates to you again. What's the stick? We're going to go back to where we started from now. I'm not quite sure. Short of, and Art, I guess the question is, you know, you talk about the red line. Are we willing to go marching in there?
No, obviously we're not. I would hope we're not. And
I'm
I don't
not.
Think anybody's that stupid. I honestly don't. I think lessons have been learned.
From your ears. That's the hope.
I hope so. I really don't. I'd be shocked. I'd be speechless.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the end of it, you're going to set these things up, and to me, it's another one of these situations, as we've been doing in the Middle East for, you know, my entire life. You have these, you know, big smiling press conferences where we're shaking hands and patting each other on the back. Yes, we've gotten something done. Hooray for us. And then a couple months later, it all falls apart, and now you're back at this, and it's just this continual rolling ball.
Yes. That is that is true, and I think that I do think, though, that they are going to have to come up with something. I think there is going to be some international pressure, and don't forget they want to sell their oil.
Yeah, well, international pressure, let somebody else do it. I'm more and more becoming a George Washington fan. Stay clear of foreign entanglements.
Right, as we call entangling alliances.
There you go. I'll tell you. Anyway, Ellen, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you so much.
The Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Jesse Woodson James would live only 34 years, but in that short period of time, he became a living legend. Jesse James was born in Clay County, Missouri in 1847 to a Baptist minister who made money as a hemp farmer. He had an older brother and a younger sister. When Jesse was 3, his father gave in to the fever of the gold rush and left the family for California, where he soon died from disease that had spread throughout a community of prospectors. Jesse's mother remarried twice, and the second one worked out. Jesse's new stepfather was a doctor who moved into the James house, the only home Jesse ever knew growing up. One thing his father and stepfather had in common had a significant influence on young Jesse. His father had 6 slaves and his stepfather had 7. Join us again for the making of a Confederate outlaw. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Sometimes it pays just to go away. You could ask Jim Skinner about that. He was CEO of the hamburger behemoth McDonald's, pulling down a hefty $8.8 million in pay. Last year, though, Skinner retired. And rather than getting a gold watch, he was given a load of gold, so large that even a Brinks armored truck would have been too small to haul it all away. His salary of $753,000 was the least of it. The Big Mac chain also served up $1.7 million to the chief in stock and $3 million in option awards. Then it slathered on another $10.2 million in retirement pay. All that was topped by a super-rich dessert. $11.6 million in incentive pay. What? Why does a guy with millions already on his food tray need any incentive to do his job? Maybe because Skinner found it hard to stomach the biggest part of his job, which was to pay poverty wages to McDonald's 800,000 workers, shove thousands of them onto food stamps and other programs paid for by taxpayers, and lobby aggressively to prevent any increases in minimum wage or any tax hikes on uber-rich elites like him. It's dirty work, but Skinner did it, finally skipping away with a 2012 pay package totaling $27.7 million. Yet, in the phantasmagoric plutocracy of corporate land, too much is not enough. Last year, for the first time ever, the 10 highest-paid CEOs in America hauled in at least $100 million each. even as the great majority of workaday families have lost income. This is Jim Hightower saying, this gaping and ever-widening inequality is the greatest threat to our society's cohesion. Too few people now control an unconscionable and untenable share of America's money and power, using it to grab more of both for themselves.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Sometimes it pays just to go
away. Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Your kids are ready, let me go.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, Colorado College, a small liberal arts college there in Colorado, evidently they have added the word queer to the application process for job applicants. Evidently, they've got male, female, transgender, not disclosed, and now queer. And you got to go, really? Why would you? I always thought that was an insult. I don't know why you would throw that out there. And I guess it's part of the, look, I'm not up on the acronyms, but I guess it's LBGTQ now. So I guess by adding the Q, they thought it was okay. Hey, let's throw it in there. I got to be honest. There's part of me that goes, how about a section of mind your own freaking business? How about that? Really just very, very bizarre. You know, I had this moment of despair this afternoon, though, as I was getting ready for the show. A couple of the websites I go to, and I'm just, scanning the daily information, seeing what's out there. I'm looking at this site, and I'm not going to say which one, but I'm looking at this site. Every story that they had, all of it was bad news. All of it was horrible, and not just bad, but the kind where you go, man, I just want to rip my eyes out. I don't want to watch this. I don't want to see this. The first story on the page, and I just flipped to it, the first page, Connecticut father drugs daughter so he can rape her 12-year-old friend. That's the first story. Second story, Pat Robertson. Parents should suspect gay kids were molested and recruited into homosexuality. Third story, right down the list. GOP lawmakers scheduled to take part in rally calling for Obama's overthrow in second American Revolution. Then down the list again, Catholic Church yanks major YMCA grants over links to LGBT support groups. Then down you go, pastor heads children's ministry after arrest for sexually abusing a minor. And I'm going, really? And then the next one was neighbor. Woman acted confused after crashing her car shortly before homeowner shot her to death. Then the next one is, the Fox News guest, terrorists like Al-Qaeda couldn't have run Obamacare worse. I'm going, really, is there no good news? And when I was looking at these stories, I go, what do I have to choose from? What is it of any of this stuff do I want to talk about? And, it just leaves you going, we got a lot of work to do. I look at the shooting, the woman who got shot, crashed her car, went and knocked on the door and said, hey, I'm looking for help because, and look, at the end of the day, wasn't a black woman knocking on the door. I don't think she'd have gotten shot, but it was, unfortunately. And the guy, the guy who shot her, it was an accident. The gun kind of helped. But now the neighbors, she acted confused. Well, of course she acted confused. She crashed her car. Sad. Sad stuff. I'm hoping the news cycle tomorrow a little bit better. Anyway, I'm looking forward to tomorrow. I can talk more about what's going on over in the General Assembly. Can't wait for the hilarity to ensue. Maybe transportation will be discussed, or maybe not. If you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, Stitcher on your smartphone. Thanks for being here. Looking forward to talking to you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like a tide flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. The most